Good Wednesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady right here on SiriusXM Patriot 125 NRA TV. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you're with us today. We are going to be covering for the next 3 hours the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia earlier today. Michael Graham of Media DC, resident of the Alexandria, Virginia area, going to join us in about 20 minutes or so. Also, Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania will be with us later on in the hour. Obviously, producer Cameron Gray, living in Alexandria. What, Cameron? Just a couple of blocks away from where this happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, to get to work, I have to go. Everything happened on Monroe Avenue, and I was, as I turned to take my right to come to work, I looked straight ahead, and there's the entire scene, and you see nothing but satellite trucks. I wasn't a witness, but I was a witness to the aftermath, and it's quite unbelievable to have it happen in, you know, right here in Alexandria, where we are sitting right now, where you'll be tomorrow and Friday.
Absolutely. We'll talk with Stephen Gutowski, the Washington Free Beacon, who offices in Northern Virginia as well. Plus, John Cardillo, former New York police officer, will join us. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, whose recent book just came out, Indian Country, all about the splitting of this country into a civil war, a speculative work of fiction, and one he has said many times that he hopes remains a wrong speculation. No, Kurt does not want to see this country descend into the partisan violence that he saw in Kosovo as a member of our armed services. James Delipoole of Breitbart London will join us on the program as well. A British police commissioner in some trouble for perhaps coming close to considering the idea that armed citizens might be able to protect themselves and others in a terrorist attack. And, of course, that's what is playing out on social media right now as well. Anti-gun activists, really within a matter of minutes of this story being reported, were already out in full force following the playbook of the Preventing Gun Violence Through Effective Messaging handbook that came out in 2012. Tells them to get on social media right away. Tells them to talk about the need for, in this case now, gun safety, right? You don't want to say gun control. Don't get specific. Don't offer up specific solutions, but just talk about the need for more gun safety so that stuff like this doesn't happen anymore. And again, that started within minutes. Now, within a couple of hours, we started to learn more about what took place. Congressman Steve Scalise, shot and wounded in surgery. Looks like he's going to be okay. You had two Capitol Police officers who returned fire, who were also injured. It looks like they, thankfully, are going to be okay. Five people total taken to the hospital. And President Donald Trump, I'm going to play this a little bit out of order chronologically speaking. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe made some comments at the mid-morning press conference. A few minutes later, President Donald Trump spoke to the nation. I want to play the president first, and then I want to share with you what Governor McAuliffe had to say. But take a look and a listen to President Donald Trump addressing the nation this morning, talking about this attack in Alexandria, Virginia.
As you all know, shortly after 7 a.m. this morning, a gunman opened fire on members of Congress and their staffs as they were practicing for tomorrow's annual charity baseball game. Authorities are continuing to investigate the crime, and the assailant has now died from his injuries. The FBI is leading the investigation and will continue to provide updates as new information becomes available. Congressman Steve Scalise, a member of House leadership, was shot and badly wounded and is now in stable condition at the hospital, along with two very courageous Capitol police officers. At least two others were also wounded. Many lives would have been lost if not for the heroic actions of the two Capitol police officers who took down the gunman despite sustaining gunshot wounds during a very, very brutal assault. Melania and I are grateful for their heroism and praying for the swift recovery of all victims. Congressman Scalise is a friend and a very good friend. He's a patriot and he's a fighter. He will recover from this assault. And Steve, I want you to know that you have the prayers not only of the entire city behind you, but of an entire nation and, frankly, the entire world. America is praying for you, and America is praying for all of the victims of this terrible shooting. I spoke with Steve's wife, Jennifer, and I pledged to her our full and absolute support. Anything she needs, we're with her and with the entire Scalise family. I have also spoken with Chief Matthew Verderosa. He's doing a fantastic job of the Capitol Police to express our sympathies for his wounded officers and to express my admiration for their courage. Our brave Capitol Police perform a challenging job with incredible skill, and their sacrifice makes democracy possible. We also commend the brave first responders from Alexandria Police Fire and Rescue who rushed to the scene. Everyone on that field is a public servant. Our courageous police, our congressional aides who work so tirelessly behind the scenes with enormous devotion, and our dedicated members of Congress who represent our people. We may have our differences, but we do well in times like these to remember that everyone who serves in our nation's capital is here because, above all, they love our country. We can all agree that we are blessed to be Americans, that our children deserve to grow up in a nation of safety and peace, and that we are strongest when we are unified and when we work together for the common good. Please take a moment today to cherish those you love and always remember those who serve and keep us safe. God bless them all. God bless you. And God bless America. Thank you.
Again, President Donald Trump speaking to the nation earlier today. Shortly before the president addressed the nation, Governor Terry McAuliffe was at a press conference in Alexandria, Virginia, along with Alexandria Police and I believe the Capitol Police Chief. Now, you heard the president. President didn't get divisive. President didn't talk policy. President didn't mention things like national right to carry reciprocity. Didn't say it would have been better off if people were carrying a gun. Didn't bring politics or policy into it. Now listen to Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe.
What happened here is that there is no additional threat in Washington.
I can tell you from the Virginia's perspective, from my Secretary of Public Safety, Brian Moran, who's here with me, and VDEM, we had no prior information that lead us to believe that anything like this was going to occur.
Governor, in general, do you think anything more needs to do to protect politicians?
Well, let me say this. I think we need to do more to protect all of our citizens. I have long advocated, this is not what today is about, but there are too many guns on the street. We lose 93 million Americans a day to gun violence. I mean, I've long talked about this. Background checks, shutting down gun show loopholes. You know, that's not for today's discussion, but it's not just about politicians.
Governor,
we worry about this every day for all of our citizens.
Why, if it's not the day for, why are you bringing it up? People are going to criticize that you're bringing up gun control at this time.
Well, I'm talking about this every single day. This is a very serious issue. You know, I just came with Colonel Flaherty recently. You know, we just buried one of our great state troopers, a special agent, with a wife and three young children, needless, senseless. So we've got to look at this. But I'm not going to get anywhere near the investigation. The FBI is leading this. But this, obviously, with 93 million people a day, it's just something.
Sir, just checking, 93 million is a big number. Did you mean to say 93 million? That's a big number. Are you sure about
93
that?
93 million, 93 individuals a day.
93 individuals
a day.
How confident are you there aren't any other attacks?
Any other briefings throughout the day?
How confident are you this was the one and only and there couldn't be other attacks?
I can just tell you from Virginia's perspective, we monitor all this. We had no threats before. We're not concurring looking at that. As it relates to this incident, this is totally up to the FBI and the local law enforcement.
Sir, there's so much acrimony right now in the political discourse and dialogue in this country. There's so much back and forth and venomous discussion. Are you concerned that that climate in any way contributed to what we saw today, or do you have thoughts about the climate we're in?
I can't answer on today. The investigation is going on. I do think things have become very partisan, very hardened in this country today. We got to begin to work together to get things done. We're the greatest nation on earth, and there has been too much, I believe, raw discourse in this country today that's pulling people apart as general, and we need to work together to bring people together, to work together. As governor, I worry about economic development, education, transportation, basic things that people here in Virginia want, and that's what we need to focus our energies on.
Again, Governor Terry McAuliffe bringing up gun control, saying it's not for today, but it's for every day at the same time, talking about the need for more gun control laws in the state of Virginia, perhaps the nation as well, while also saying that we need to come together, we need to quit trying to pull people apart. Two very different, I think, responses. Now, one, again, a formal statement, one, a Q&A with the press, but I think two different perspectives. Seen by President Donald Trump and Governor Terry McAuliffe of Virginia. And we've seen those, I think, varying perspectives online as well. You know, Cameron, I want to bring you back in for a second because, you know, you certainly know how toxic Twitter can be. But
yes.
You think back to 2001. We didn't have Twitter. We didn't have social media. We did come together as a nation after an event like that. Even I think after a year ago, the Pulse nightclub shooting, you certainly saw people trying to make political issues, but that was mostly shouted down. There were a few loud voices, but most of the people said, look, it's not appropriate to bring politics into this. You are seeing a lot of people with blue checks by their name who are coming awfully close to, if not, saying, oh, good that this happened. That these congressmen had it coming,
right? And the party had it coming too. This is the pretty much the summary is you reap what you sow, is a lot of the messages summed up. And you're right, it's we're seeing a lot of calls. You know, I don't want to name names, but you're seeing a lot of people. Oh, it's time for political civility and time to tone down the rhetoric. Yes, and I agree, but that time wouldn't be here if this wasn't a guy who was a Bernie supporter and a guy who was obviously a leftist and who was members of Facebook groups like Terminate the GOP. It's always that discussion when it's someone on their side does something horrific. But if it's something like, let's go back to the Sarah Palin being blamed for the Gabby Giffords targets, something make an association. There was no one ever had any proof that it was ever put together, but somebody made, out of thin air, they made an association that became a dominant narrative. You have here someone who actually had Bernie Sanders as his Facebook avi, huge fan of Bernie Sanders, huge hater of the GOP, and now it's, oh, let's tone down the rhetoric. Let's not associate the two. Which is it? You can't have it both ways, and you always talk about, you know, play the left's game by the left's rules. I mean, that's the dominant narrative in this country right now. So do we have to play by those rules? I don't like to go down that path, but you can't make up something like what happened with the tragedy of Gabby Giffords, and then say now, oh no, let's take politics out of it. You it's got to be one or the other.
Well, you know, look, we see these sides revert to the tribal politics, even if it's an inconsistent position, they're going to revert to their defensive position, if it's exactly the opposite position that they took a year or two ago. And you can point out the inconsistency, and frankly, I don't think it will change anything. Now, you know, I saw Bernie Sanders came out earlier today strongly condemning this attack, as I think everybody does. I don't hold Bernie Sanders responsible for this any more than I hold the firearm responsible for this. This was an attack committed by an individual who apparently decided that that members of Congress, Republican members of Congress, needed to die. I don't even listen. I'm not even going to go out there and go on this, you know, rant about a toxic media and the toxic stuff you see on the left or the toxic stuff you see on the right, because I don't want to pass any laws that would ban the freedom of speech, that would restrict what we have the right to say or do. But I will note, I was looking at this guy's Facebook page earlier today, and this guy was marinating in this. 99.9% of the Facebook posts that I saw, and I kind of scanned around going back to 2013, 99.9% of those posts were political. Since the election, it has been, I would say, of the posts that I saw, about 90-plus percent attacking Republicans, about 10% putting forth an idea that that he believed in, other than Republicans suck and are terrorists and need to be terminated. Of the dozens and dozens and dozens of posts that I looked at, I saw one post of what looked to be a grandchild on a lake smiling and a comment about that child. That was it. One post. I do think that there is something toxic about spending too much time in these social media waters. And again, when you're marinating in it 24 hours a day, there weren't many people commenting. In fact, I don't think I saw anybody comment on any of this guy's posts. Got a couple of likes, but not a huge Facebook presence. A prolific presence, but not one with a lot of followers. And I wonder about the damage done. Again, when you isolate yourself, when you stew in this, and this attitude that that we should block ourselves off, that we shouldn't ever talk to somebody that we disagree with. The congresswoman in Seattle a couple of weeks ago who got cheers at the city council meeting, when she said, "I don't have any Republican friends." You know, I've said this before. I wrote about this last week, actually, at America's First Freedom. I know people, because I'm in the NRA and because I support the right to keep and bear arms, I know people who I wouldn't have met otherwise. People with very different backgrounds who live very different lives than I do. People who have very different opinions about a lot of things than I do. And I know them because on this opinion, the importance of the right to keep and bear arms, we agree and we come together and we work in a common cause. I know Democrats. I know straight-laced religious conservatives. I know a lot of atheists. I know Jewish gun owners. I know Sikh gun owners. I know people, again, across the political spectrum. And I think I'm better for that. I think I'm a more well-rounded individual because of that. And I know that I've gotten to meet some really cool people that I wouldn't have met otherwise. And I worry that in this country we're going the opposite direction. And certainly based on this guy's, solely on this guy's Facebook feed, that was the direction that he was running headlong into. Siloing himself, stewing in the most toxic juices possible, and just fermenting and fomenting that hatred for his fellow Americans. All right, we're going to step away for a moment or two. You got something, Cameron?
Just real quick, as you go to break, this just came across Twitter from a friend of the Daily Caller. Shooter's Facebook group celebrates attack. It's that group I mentioned to terminate the Republican Party. The post in this anti-Republican Facebook group said, "And it's 1, 2, 3 shots you're out at the old ball game." This is the sickness that's out there. They celebrate.
Yeah. The official Antifa response apparently was a picture of some people marching with a banner that said, "The only good fascist is a dead fascist." That was their reaction to the shooting of Steve Scalise. And now again, as Cameron said, one of these Facebook groups that this guy belonged to. You know, again, we're not going to solve this today. Wish we could. We still have almost 3 hours left, but I still don't think we're going to solve this today. But we are going to talk about it today. And we're not going to shy away as I think many members of the media and frankly many Americans have shied away from this. We don't want to talk about how ugly it's gotten. We don't want to talk about how scary it is out there right now. But we're going to talk about it today because we need to. Stick around. We're just getting started. We'll be back with Michael Graham coming up right after this. Right now, I want to welcome the president of the Pharma Compliance Group, Mr. Matt Murphy, is with us on the program. Every day there are these stories. I mean, there was one yesterday from Ohio. A mother faces child endangerment charges after reportedly overdosing in a Chuck E. Cheese bathroom. 34-year-old Michelle Wagner reportedly snorted heroin and overdosed in the bathroom on Tuesday. Well, she was at the Chuck E. Cheese in Coleraine Township, Ohio, with her 7-year-old son, her 5-year-old daughter. They were able to give her Narcan. She survived. She's taken to the hospital. Now she's facing charges. And these stories, Matt, I mean, we're seeing these stories every day around the country, and it seems to be getting worse.
It is getting worse. There's no doubt about it, Cam. And this problem has transitioned from prescription drug use and misuse and abuse probably 10 or 15 years ago. And because heroin is more powerful, cheaper, and now sometimes laced with fentanyl, we're seeing that people are overdosing all the time because now they're purchasing heroin, again, which is cheaper and more powerful, as opposed to a prescription drug that was made in a pristine or manufactured in a pristine environment. So, you know, the pressure is ramped up on law enforcement and treatment centers to help people. And that's also what we've seen in the news quite a bit lately is the resources that are being put forth to assist people who have addiction issues. But the problem has been around for quite some time. And, you know, I remember seeing it with DEA back with the internet before the Ryan Haight Act legislation was passed that outlawed a prescriber from issuing a controlled substance prescription without at least one face-to-face visit with the patient. But that's how it started. And now with heroin being so readily available, it's just become an epidemic, which is the catchword that's used today.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Every animal that has ever roamed this planet was designed as hunted or hunter, predator or prey. We are hunters. If it were ever necessary, even the strictest vegan would return to the wild, driven to survive by the instincts of his ancestors. Those who hide behind the soft delusion of their own ignorance do so from within a civilization whose very being costs the lives of countless creatures every single day. Death is an undeniable fuel of life. This is the undeniable truth of existence. To live in balance with the planet that sustains us, we must admit and embrace the nature within us. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, continuing our coverage of the attack on members of Congress in a Alexandria, Virginia baseball practice field. These members of Congress getting ready for tomorrow's congressional baseball game, which looks like it will be going forward, by the way, at Nationals Park in Washington, D.C., I am sure, under very, very tight security. But there was not tight security there in Virginia. Thankfully, Steve Scalise, member of the House Majority Leadership Team, had his security detail with him as he was practicing. and they were able to respond and engage this attacker. Alexandria police arrived. You know, it's interesting. The initial reports from congressmen, they were saying like it was 10 minutes before a response got there. Police responded within about 3 minutes, according to Alexandria police. But again, when you're under attack, each second feels like an eternity. And you've got people on Twitter today trying to make politics out of this, trying to say that we need more gun control laws, we need fewer armed citizens, that we can honor police officers by passing more gun control laws. Well, what they mean is they want you, if you were ever in that situation, to not be able to protect yourself, to wait those agonizing seconds until help arrives. Michael Graham is with us on the program, coming to us today from Boston, Massachusetts, in the newsroom of the Boston Herald. Michael, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, and I want to commend you. You know, I hate saying anything nice about you, Cam. It pains me. But your comments earlier about reaching outside your silo are so key right now. On the one hand, you do have the anti-gun kooks who honestly, earnestly believe, and they will tell you if you put them on the record, yes, citizens should die rather than be able to have the ability to defend themselves by legally owning a gun. But on the other side, we've seen a lot of people on the right who are jumping on the typical liberal argument of conversation, content caused this crime. All the anti-Trump bashing caused this crime. And Cam, you and I are in the conservative media. We know how slippery this slope is because every time there's an act of violence, the mainstream media immediately turn to talk radio, conservative columnists, podcasters like me, streaming video operators like yourself, and they say, look what you did. You know, talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, whoever, they cause violence with their words and their arguments, so we need to silence your arguments. And I'm begging my conservative friends, don't jump on that bandwagon. I know that the left does. And your point about need to, instead of saying, I want to shut down your argument, if you had people in the Bernie Sanders community and people in the Trump community talking and listening to each other, actually hearing the arguments instead of simply labeling each other as haters and anti-American and idiots and blah, 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 then that would change the climate. Not ending the arguments and the content, but listening to the other guy's argument and content.
Well, I think that's a huge part of the disconnect that we're seeing right now is that, again, it's when we do listen, when we do engage, it's 140 characters at a time, right? Or yep. It's an angry Facebook post or rant. Person to person, it seems like outside of Congress, the most visible contact between people on the left and the right are when people on the left are in the right's face yelling and screaming that they should be fired for whatever sin that they've committed. And you know, look, don't get me wrong, Michael. I think that there is an atmosphere on the left of not endorsing violence, but really getting off on the idea of this theoretical violence, whether it's Kathy Griffin holding up Trump's head or the assassination of Julius Trump in Shakespeare in the Park. There's an atmosphere of assassination chic, I think it was called by one of our guests yesterday. And I'm not saying that it leads to crimes like this. It's still the individual who is responsible for the crime that they committed. But it is a very ugly atmosphere. And I would argue, Michael, that it is a very different atmosphere than what we saw from the right after Barack Obama was elected president. And I think we have to talk about those differences, too.
I mean, you know, the phrase assassination chic actually comes from the George W. Bush era because there were plays on off Broadway and there were novels that were fantasy novels about assassinating George W. Bush. So you're right. There's always been in the left these wussies who, you know, they can't even handle, a slingshot or a potato gun, want to get all, hey, let me tell you, I got there and rip off some heads. You know, so there is that. I have no masculinity in my life. I can't even use pronouns that are gender, specific, but I can talk big and tough about cutting off Donald Trump's head. So I agree. But if we don't defend the principle that speech must continue and that speech is not violence, then I'm telling you, the left can't wait to declare speech as violence and start arresting, mm-hmm. for example, pastors who preach that homosexuality is a sin. They cannot wait to run through that door, and I don't want to see us opening that door. And you know what? If more listening happens, that's the way, in my opinion, to close down the door. And that's why I think your comment about silos was so dead on. It's easy to talk about how disgusting and how someone deserves to die for supporting Trump if you don't know anybody who supported Trump.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that most of the individuals on that Facebook page that were celebrating the shooting that the shooter belonged to, I'm guessing that most of those individuals are fairly siloed. They don't know any Trump supporters, or if they do know them, they don't like them, right? It's the in-law that they can't stand or something like that. But, you know, here's the other thing, Michael, that really does concern me is that I agree with what you're saying. I think we've seen some I thought what the president said today was very appropriate. Yep. The politicians are saying the right thing. They're you know, talking about the need to come together. But yet I'm seeing on Twitter, I mentioned Marcos Moulitsis earlier. He had tweeted something from Rand Paul about the Second Amendment being for the use against government under tyranny. And right. Marcos Moulitsis' comment was, Republicans are getting what they want, indicating that apparently the way to fight tyranny is to shoot unarmed Congress members at a baseball practice. I don't know about you, Michael. You're there in Boston. Lexington and Concord, from what I read in the history books, played out a little bit differently. I mean, and this to me is one of the key differences. The right had the Tea Party. You go back to the Tea Party in history, what did they do? They dumped tea in the Boston Harbor, right? They right. hid guns so they couldn't be confiscated. And when it came time to defend their lives and their properties, they stood their ground against a government that had turned on them. Now we've got on the left the resistance, right? And the resistance is all about resisting this unlawful government that has come in and taken over. Harkens back to the French resistance of World War II. That wasn't about throwing tea in harbor, right? That was about killing Nazis. That was about killing an invading and occupying force. And I got to tell you, I think the opposition to President Obama and the opposition to President Trump ideologically and fundamentally are coming from very different places and have very different psychologies.
Well, I will say that the behavior is very different. You know, I wrote a book a few years ago about the Tea Party and how it started called That's No Angry Mob, That's My Mom. And I have a whole chapter in the book on how the media kept reporting how dangerous the Tea Party was, you know, to your physical well-being, like how they were on the verge of a riot and you never know. And anytime there would be a shoot, remember the Gabby Gifford shooting, and somehow they took, you know, they thought this guy was a Tea Party, had nothing to do with the Tea Party. He was an insane guy, literally with a satanic ritual thing in his yard. And I compared all that to the actual violence. And there was virtually no violence in which Tea Partiers, you know, committed it. Now you look at how much violence we've had just since Trump has won the election. There's been far more violence already. And I'm not putting this shooting in this category because this guy probably just mentally ill. But the organized violence, you know, throwing stuff through windows, riots at Berkeley, burning copies of the Washington Examiner magazine, the streets of Washington, D.C. There's been more violence already by the, quote, resistance, and there ever was by the Tea Party. But if you ask the typical member of the media or the typical person here in Massachusetts on the left, which one is more prone to violence, which one is urging violence, they'll say it's those NRA-supporting right-wing Tea Partiers.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're right. Michael, I'm curious. We originally had scheduled you to come on and talk about the special election in Georgia next week. Obviously, the news in Alexandria preempting a lot of other conversations today. But in the minute or so that we have left, first of all, I almost hate to ask this question because it sounds a little crass and political. But do you think an event like this can have an impact on a special election in Georgia? And secondly, what is your take on the state of that race right now? The polls seem to indicate that this is really a jump ball right now for either John Ossoff or Karen Handel.
A year ago, I lived in the district in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Tom Price was my congressman. I had him on my radio show many times. The idea that that district would go Democrat is just wow. But that it's all about Trump, the surge in Democratic turnout in early voting. The Republicans say they're now kind of catching up. There's some Republicans who are hoping that this is going to end up being a net wash. That there'll be enough turnout from Republicans to make this a normal election, base versus base. And if it's base versus base, then Karen Handel, a very unimpressive candidate, should narrowly hang on. But I now live in Georgia. I mean, in Virginia, as you know, work in D.C. I'm in Boston today. But in Virginia Tuesday, 70% increase in Democratic turnout over their previous record, not previous average, previous record. The anti-Trump vote is out there. It is pouring out. Could an event like this where, you know, someone who was a Bernie Sanders person was shooting at Republicans cause some Trump supporters, some Republicans to say, I've got to send a message to the left that their extremism is intolerable. I've got to stand for my team. It might have a minimal impact. I'm not sure.
All right, Michael, listen, I do appreciate your time today, sir. Thanks very much and look forward to talking again soon.
Under much more pleasant circumstances next time, okay?
I certainly hope so. Michael Graham, creative director at Media DC with us. I am M. Graham on Twitter. When we come back here on Cam and Company, Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania is going to join us talking more about that shooting in Alexandria. We'll find out if Congressman Kelly has had a chance to talk to any of his colleagues who were there on the baseball practice field. I know that members of Congress have had a briefing already, so we'll talk with him about that and he'll give us what he can in terms of the briefing that members of Congress receive. So stick around. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Travis Rupert with Hunts for Healing Incorporated, what is Hunts for Healing?
Hi, John. Thanks. What Hunts for Healing is a completely voluntary 501(c)-based organization that is aimed at getting combat wounded veterans, physically, emotionally, and mentally injured vets that are post 9/11. We get them, we bring them up to our facility up in Lacyville, Pennsylvania, which is located in Susquehanna County. And we bring them up completely, take care of all of their food, amenities, staying, and they basically just have to show up. And we basically get them back out into the outdoors, you know, the outdoors and hunting, fishing, any type of activity associated with the outdoors is shown through evidence-based practice to really help vets get over physical and mental and emotional disabilities that they come back home with.
How did this all come about?
Hunts for Healing was started back in 1994 by a lady of the name of Mindy Picotti. She was fortunate enough to come across a very big parcel of land. And herself being a vet, had an epiphany one day cleaning her house about what she could do with all this land. And it literally, she calls it an answer from God, but it allowed her at that point in time to basically have this vision and put together this organization to bring vets in. And that's how it pretty much all got started, just by some old lady cleaning her house.
That's crazy. You have these different places, Travis, where you do your best thinking. Probably thought about it and got a message from the man upstairs and off you went.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the things that we're different than most other veteran organizations is if you look at our logo, it says emotional, spiritual, and physical. So we do a lot of our things. We do have a God-based belief, and we don't force it on anyone, but that's kind of the thread, I believe, that keeps Hunts for Healing together, you know, that it really keeps it all and brings it all as far as the spiritual and the emotional type healing that really tends to help a lot of guys, even if they're not religious, you know, when they come to us, a lot of them say, hey, you know what? I decided to start going to church and it's really helping me.
That's cool. Speaking of Travis Rupert with Hunts for Healing Incorporated. So Travis, why do you do this? Why is this important to you?
I do this. Hunts for Healing, believe it or not, actually, I tell everybody I speak to, Hunts for Healing saved my life. I myself was in the position that a lot of our vets are in. They come back, they know they have a problem, they know they're broken or they have emotional or, you know, physical issues, and they don't know how to deal with it. Until I hooked up with Mindy and Hunts for Healing, I was at a very, very bad place. So seeing what they did for me and how they turned my life around, I feel it's my duty and my obligation to give back, not only to just the organization that saved my life, but to also every other veteran, brother, sister that's coming back that may need the help. That's why I do it. And I can speak pretty much for everybody involved with Hunts for Healing. They all have the same motivation for doing what we do.
Give me a typical example, Travis, of a story that's or a vet that's really touched you.
Okay. I would have to actually go with a gentleman. We'll call him George for the sake of speaking. George came to us. It was actually my second event as a mentor after I'd gone through the program. And he came, and he was very, I don't know how to really to explain it, but he needed to be there. He really needed to be there. He had a lot of trouble dealing with his emotional problems, had problems like with home, you know, being at home, and just really felt like he was lost. I mean, and I got to spend 5 straight days with him in a hunting turkeys and stuff, and just seeing the transformation from this broken little, you know, 18-year-old, 19-year-old, what I thought was a kid, coming back from the war, you know, completely lost, and then only after spending 5 days with us, he basically is almost like my own poster child. I see myself when I look at him, because I was there and I can completely relate, empathize, and sympathize with these guys. But George is the guy that I'll always remember no matter what, just because there was nothing really special in, you know, but it was just the time spent together and the healing that occurred with inside him, and seeing that on, you know, day 5 when he left, that right there is something I'll never forget.
All right, quickly, how will we get more information about Hunts for Healing?
The best bet to do is get on the web, www.huntsforhealing.org. Again, we're 501(c), so every penny we make makes it right back to the veterans. Nobody takes a salary and a paycheck, so that is the best way to get a hold of Mindy to find out more information and to see what Hunts for Healing is all about.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Next hour, Stephen Gutowski of the Washington Free Beacon joins us. Also, James Delapole of Breitbart London about the British police commissioner getting in some trouble for suggesting, maybe going along with the idea that armed citizens might be able to defend themselves and others during a terrorist attack. Right now, very pleased to have with us on the program, Congressman from Pennsylvania, on Twitter at Mike Kelly PA. Congressman Mike Kelly is with us. Congressman, good afternoon, sir.
Oh, good afternoon, Cam. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. First of all, let me just send our best wishes to you and all of your colleagues in Congress on what is, I am sure, across the nation, for many of us, not all of us, unfortunately, but for many of us, this is a very troubling day. This is a recognition, perhaps, of the troubling time that we live in. But I'm sure for you and your colleagues here on Capitol Hill, it must be 1,000 times worse. What can you tell us about what life is like today in the Capitol?
Well, you know, it's very somber right now, and the whole House, and both sides of the aisle, by the way. And I think our speaker was very articulate and said that an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. I know that members feel that way. Mike Doyle is a really good friend of mine from Pittsburgh, Democrat, by the way, came over to see me, came across and said, "Hey, are you okay?" And I said, "Oh, I'm fine." He goes, "Isn't this horrible?" And, you know, so we all agree that something like this is totally out of bounds. It should never happen anywhere in the world, let alone in the United States of America. This is not the way Americans react to things. But unfortunately, Cam, am I shocked that it happened? Absolutely not. I'm saddened that it happened. But again, I've watched the rhetoric, and I've watched what's been going on since the morning of November the 9th, when Donald Trump was elected president. The indivisible people, the resist people, have been hot on the heels of everything that they could. And the rhetoric, you know, Cam, when a comedian or supposedly comedian holds up the severed head of the president, of President Trump, when there's plays on Broadway that show the president and the first lady being assassinated, and then people saying, well, you know, we're allowed to have free speech. You know, I get that that's the way they like to play that card. But I got to tell you, to me, it has been so over the top. The social media feeds an awful lot of this, but this fanning the flames of hate has got to stop. I will be the first one to tell you that during the years that Barack Obama was in office, I was almost 100% against almost every policy he had. But that's where it ended. It was about not agreeing with his policy, and it was not about attacking him as a human being the way this president has been attacked. And so it's so polarized right now, and I know the members on both sides feel this way, by the way. And I don't want anybody to think, oh, no, this isn't the way it works. Look, there's enough on both sides right now for us to take a step back and say, are we really acting responsibly? Are we acting the way Americans act and react? But most importantly, you know, listen, It's all right to disagree with each other, and it's all right to have those heated debates, but it's not okay to, again, as I said earlier, fan the flames of hatred. And it just can't be that every time we have a policy that we're racist for suggesting it, that we're less than human beings, that we have no hearts. I've heard people say we come out with a health care bill and say this is going to kill people. They have no respect for people. When you put that kind of a message out there and then act shocked that this type of behavior takes place, I sit back and say, come on, you know what? There's enough blame to go around. And this is not a day for pointing fingers. It is a day for praying that we start to look at who we are as a people. And I want to point something out. Steve Scalise is a friend of mine. Steve Scalise is married to a really lovely girl. He has two children. There's just no way that people, I think, anymore relate that these folks are people. They're moms and dads, they're husbands and wives, they're grandpas and grandmas. And these are good people who've come to serve, and they ran for office and they got elected. These are not people to be hated. These are not people to be vilified. These are not people to be attacked. And it's happening in our offices. It's happening in our hometowns. It's happening at our own homes. And I just say, you know what? Come on. This has been going on for too long. Don't sit back and pretend that you didn't know it was happening or that in some ways you're not responsible for some of this hatred that's out there today.
Talking again with Congressman Mike Kelly. And you know, Congressman, we talked about this, I think, the last time we had you on the program, the protesters going outside of people's homes. This is part of the attempt, I think, to otherize people that we disagree with, right? You talk about the fact that in order to engage in an attack like this, you can't see these members of Congress as human beings, right? They're just political creatures, and your ideology blinds you to your common humanity. And unfortunately, I think that, again, we're seeing more of that. I go back to what we were talking about with our last guest, Mr. Michael Graham. You know, you saw the Tea Party firsthand there in Pennsylvania in the wake of the election of Barack Obama. And I think that the psychology of the Tea Party movement came from a very different place than the psychology of, quote unquote, the resistance that we're seeing right now. I just think that with the Tea Party was a group of Americans who felt like government wasn't listening to them, felt like they wanted representation if they were going to have taxation, felt like they weren't being represented. We're concerned about the direction of the country and wanted to mobilize and engage in a grassroots effort to show that this was a real mass movement. The resistance is, it seems to me, Congressman, to be all about drawing its motivation from the French resistance of World War II. Y'all are a bunch of Nazis, yes, up there. It's been an, yeah, invasion, right? You all are an occupying force in the United States, as opposed to a government that won't listen, which is, I think, what the Tea Party's basic complaint was, that we have a government who's not listening to us. You're an illegitimate government in the eyes of the resistance.
Amen. I mean, you just stated it so correctly. Listen, when I was running for office back in 2010, the Tea Party was very respectful. What they were talking about was policy. They weren't attacking people. They were saying this is the wrong policy. You know, the Tea Party, come on, it was taxed enough already. And it started off as an organic movement and moved on. This Indivisible and the Resist movement, and for our listeners, you can go and download this. This is 28 pages of hate. This is 28 pages of how you can completely disrupt this supposedly crazy Trump agenda. Cam, I have seen things take place since November the 9th that are just totally hate. A supposed comedian holding the severed head of a president, our President Trump, a play depicting the president being assassinated and the first lady be assassinated, and it's obvious it's President Trump and Mrs. Trump. So just imagine had that taken place during the Tea Party movement. Nothing that I ever experienced in the Tea Party movement ever attacked people personally. It was about policy that people were saying, I'm tired of a government that's gotten so big and taxes us so much and is so invasive on our personal liberties and freedoms. So it was an entirely different movement. And people say, oh, no, it was the same thing. No. Don't tell me. I was there. Now, just real quickly, part of the resistance movement, and this is important for people to know, when people can show up at my home, when people can show up at a Second Amendment rally, when people can say, this is what you have to do, you can completely resist this, go to the members' offices and totally disrupt their business, jam their phone lines. Now, I want you to think about this, and I want our listeners to think about this. Our ability to talk to our constituents, and I don't care how they vote or how they're registered, we have veterans that have very serious problems right now. And we have seniors that have very serious problems with Social Security. Our offices are there to provide aid for people to navigate very complicated federal programs. The left, this far left group, is no. Go in, disrupt their office, tie up their phone lines, prevent anybody from getting through. Go to town halls, completely disrupt a town hall, completely shout them down, make it hard for anybody there who wants to bring up an issue that's important to them to actually articulate that. This is not the way America works. This is not First Amendment, and you shout down somebody else when you don't give them an opportunity to even speak. This is not who we are as a people. And so when people tell me, well, they're just exercising their First Amendment, I say, no, come on. You know it's way beyond that. And if I ask our folks, download that indivisibleguide.com. You are going to be shocked and appalled at that movement, that resistance movement. So, Cam, listen, we're all Americans, and we want everything to be as good as it can be for our fellow citizens. We want to make sure that the government doesn't overstep its boundaries and not become too invasive into our personal life, our personal freedoms and liberties. That's what I'm more concerned about. And a government that's grown way too big, taxes us way too much, and overregulates us, that's the major problems that I see. And we have to have a dynamic and robust economy. We have to work towards that. This idea that somehow making sure that somebody can't come on your campus and speak, burning police cars, breaking into people's homes and their offices and completely occupying them and not having other citizens have their opportunity to go in and get their problems addressed, that's not an American agenda. That is totally off the charts.
Congressman, listen, it is so good talking with you. I absolutely agree. You know, no matter where you stand on the political spectrum in this country, we all face far greater enemies than each other outside of our borders. There are nations that are hostile nations that are doing their very best to try to come up with the weaponry that they could use against us. You've got terror networks across the globe that want to target. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican, a Democrat, doesn't matter who you voted for. They want to see you dead.
That's right.
Right? And those are the real true enemies that America faces. I really hope that we can look each other into the eyes and see that we're not our biggest enemy, no matter how much we may disagree, that there are much worse things out there than a neighbor who disagrees with you 100% on every political position that you hold.
You're absolutely correct. You know, our speaker said today, Cam, an attack on any one of us is an attack on all of us, and that was to the Republican Congress, but I would take it a step further. An attack on any American done in this way is an attack on every American. It goes to the very core of who we are in our form of government. So we all have to take this very personally and say, this is not going to happen on my watch. It is not going to happen to me, my family, or a neighbor, or any other American. We're there for each other.
Congressman Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania, again on Twitter at Mike Kelly PA. Congressman, thank you so much for your time, sir. I know it's a very busy day for you, but please give our best to your office, your staff, and all your colleagues.
I will. Cam, thanks so much. God bless.
Thank you, sir. Congressman Mike Kelly with us here on Cam and Company. Next hour, James Dellingpole of Breitbart London joins us. Stephen Gutowski of the Washington Free Beacon. On Twitter, Kyle Chaney, who is a reporter for Politico, had a interesting thread. He said, two weird things happened that were too small to mention in the moment, but still stuck with me this morning. While reporting from the scene, he said, I arrived, this is in Alexandria, the Delray neighborhood. I arrived less than an hour after the shooting and overheard a witness, he said, maybe mid-20s, describing the incident in vivid detail by phone. So when he hung up, I approached him and asked if he'd share the same details with me since the events were still murky. Chaney says he immediately tensed up and told me that because I was the media and he hates all media, he wouldn't tell me a thing. Kyle Chaney says, never mind that the info might have been valuable to the public at the moment, as I tried to explain, didn't matter. He said, we all leak. Second strange encounter, Kyle Chaney said, came at the nearby coffee shop. A woman working there on her laptop told me that she was relieved when she found out that the shooter was targeting members of Congress. Why? Kyle Chaney says, because at least she said it wasn't random violence. As Kyle Chaney said, is a strange and unsettling time. It is indeed a strange and unsettling time. And, you know, it's not just the blue checkmark brigade on Twitter right now who appear to be, in some cases, justifying, explaining away. They had it coming. It's not just those voices, but again, the voices in the coffee shops in the D.C. area. Oh, good. Just members of Congress, not the public at large. Again, coming up next hour, we're going to continue the discussion with Stephen Gutowski, talking about the media coverage in the immediate minutes and hours after this attack was first reported. It was, as you can imagine, in some cases, pretty abysmal. Also, James Dellingpole of Breitbart London will join us next hour. We'll have more reaction from Washington, D.C. Members of Congress are already being asked about gun control, whether or not their positions on gun control have changed, whether or not they feel it's appropriate to start talking about gun control. We'll talk about Alabama Representative Mo Brooks, who was asked about this. Also, Representative Chris Collins from Buffalo, New York area, asked and commented about this as well. So stick around. We have much more Cam and Company coming up right after this here on NRA TV and Sirius XM Patriot 125.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum. You can tell by when you first walk in this place, if you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why I say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know, you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people to make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finish second, third. And we've also, as a car owner, loaded three of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine.
at Bristol. Now I look back to think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback for whatever you say.
You know, I had put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we're in victory lane. Go up that hill, I get to do a burnout on the way up. You know, all the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. A lot of these fans here in Bristol, they were cheering loud over there in the front stretch and burning it down. And hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here every week.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. James Dellingpole of Breitbart London joining us on the program. Steve Gutowski later in the hour as well. Plus, we have continuing coverage of the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia. WWJ in Detroit, Michigan, says a Detroit representative, Mike Bishop, talking to News Radio 950, he said he was at the practice. It was around 5:30 in the morning when he got there. The attack broke out a little bit after 7. He said he and his colleagues were, quote, sitting ducks. He said, as we were standing here this morning, a gunman walked up to the fence line and just began to shoot. I was standing at home plate, and he was in the third baseline. We've had other members of Congress who were there, and those who were not present who have been asked and are responding to questions related to gun control, because, again, immediately this attack became politicized. You had the gun control groups like the Brady Campaign out there tweeting before anything was known, and that is what they are supposed to do according to their anti-gun playbook, preventing gun violence through effective messaging. We've talked about this many times before, not going to go over it again right now, but they're told, hop on social media, get out there, don't talk about any specifics, just talk about the need to do something, the need for gun safety measures, quote-unquote. Mo Brooks of Alabama, talking to ABC 7 in Washington, D.C., WJLA. Sam Sweeney, the reporter, asked him if his views had changed on the gun situation in America, as WJLA put it. Mo Brooks responded, not with respect to the Second Amendment. He said the Second Amendment, a right to bear arms, is to help ensure that we always have a republic. He said that there's a feeling of helplessness when you've got a baseball bat and the guy's got a rifle. He said, we're not going to get rid of the freedom of speech because some people say some really ugly things that hurt people's feelings. We're not going to get rid of the Fourth Amendment search and seizure rights because it allows some criminals to go free who should be behind bars. Another reporter said, this kind of threat is common to all Americans, the idea of these kind of shootings happening. Is there anything that you can do as a congressman to help alleviate the threat? Congressman Brooks said, if y'all would please forgive me, I'm emotionally distraught from what I've just seen, and these policy-type questions ought to be for a later day when we have more information about what has transpired. But again, the anti-gun activists, both within and without the media, want to make it about gun control right now. And they certainly don't want to talk about the motivation. They certainly don't want to talk about the individual suspect himself. CNN's Chris Saliza with a story says the Steve Scalise shooting has already become a political football. Yeah, well, again, that's in part because of the folks that Chris Saliza works with there at CNN. He said the shooting of Steve Scalise and four others at a baseball practice for Republican members of Congress was always going to turn quickly into politics, particularly when you ask about it and when your colleagues ask about it. Yeah, it will quickly turn to politics. Representative Chris Collins, he says, one of President Trump's most prominent congressional supporters, insisted that the shooting was directly tied to anti-Trump rhetoric from the left. Colin said on a local radio station in upstate New York, I can only hope that the Democrats do tone down the rhetoric. The rhetoric has been outrageous. The finger pointing, just the tone, the angst and the anger directed at Donald Trump, his supporters. Really, then, you know, some people would react to things like that. They get angry as well, and then you fuel the fires. Chris Eliza says, Collins also said in the same interview that, hey, we could have his gun, quote, in his pocket from this day forward. Buffalo News has a little more information on that interview. WKBW also with some additional information about that interview. He said, if you look at the, I'm talking about Congressman Chris Collins here, said, if you look at the vulnerability, he said, I assure you I have a carry permit. I will be carrying when I am out and about. He said, on a rare occasion, I'd have a gun in my glove box or something, but it's going to be in my pocket from this day forward. He was not at the baseball practice on Wednesday morning, but again, was asked about this when speaking to WKBW there outside of Buffalo, New York. Collins is from the Buffalo suburbs. And again, Collins, I haven't listened to the transcript, but I'm guessing that that comment came in response to a question about guns from the host of the radio station. So for Chris Eliza to try to make it claim that, make it seem like, well, you listen, these pro-gun members of Congress, boy, they sure are quick to start talking about guns. By the way, Chris Eliza doesn't mention anything about Terry McAuliffe, I don't think. No. Nothing in there. Newt Gingrich, he quotes. Michael Caputo, he quotes. Harlan Hill, he quotes. All about this becoming a political football. Oh, I'm sorry. Way, way down here. After Harlan Hill. No offense to Harlan Hill. Harlan Hill and I follow each other on Twitter. But, Cameron, wouldn't you put the quote from Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, above the tweet from Harlan Hill?
Yeah. Yes and yes.
Okay. I'd put the quotes from Terry McAuliffe above the comments from Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich is a former House Speaker. Terry McAuliffe is the sitting governor of Virginia.
You'd think, but then again, you don't run newsrooms, Cam.
I do not occupy the mind of Chris Eliza, that is sure. Yeah. Governor Terry McAuliffe, he says, echoed Davis's statement. Quote, I do think things have become very partisan and very hardened in the country today. He said, we have to work together to get things done. We're the greatest nation in the world, and there's been too much raw discourse today that's pulling people apart. That's the first pull quote from Chris Eliza talking, quoting Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. Now, that's not the first thing that Terry McAuliffe said. Terry McAuliffe actually talked about gun control first. Chris Eliza does mention that. He said McAuliffe also mentioned that, quote, there are too many guns on the streets. He says that's a common theme for gun control advocates in the wake of attacks like these involving guns. And then right back to Republicans. Mo Brooks, Georgia Representative Barry Loudermilk. That's it. That's it. One line about Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. Tweets from Harlan Hill, no tweets from Igor Volsky, who's been tweeting all day from the Capital Action Project and Guns Down. He's been tweeting about the need for more quote-unquote gun safety laws all day long. The Brady campaign was out, I think, within an hour of this shooting being reported with their first gun control tweets. But Chris Eliza of CNN, in his story about the political football that the shooting has become, gives scant attention to what the anti-gun groups are actually doing. Doesn't even quote any of the anti-gun groups. Just says that McAuliffe had mentioned that, boy, we got too many guns on the street, and says, that's a common theme for gun control advocates in the wake of attacks like these involving guns. And then move on. Unbelievable. Unbelievable reporting. And, you know, LifeSat.com, reporting about some of the celebrities who were chiming in. Jeffrey Wright from Westworld. Too many stupid bleepers in our country with too many bleeping guns. I say others such as Rosie O'Donnell have taken to retweeting and agreeing with the liberal journalists and activists on Twitter who've been talking up gun control. David Frum, I got to mention David Frum as well, New York Times columnist. who again, very early on, when we didn't really know a whole lot about what had happened in Alexandria, Virginia, David Frum tweets out this erroneous tweet about Virginia's gun laws. There's no licensing there, and there's no background checks, and you can open carry a long gun. You can concealed carry a long gun without a permit. And you, I don't know how you'd conceal carry a long gun without a permit, but David Frum very, very quick to start talking about Virginia's gun laws. As it turns out, this guy is from Illinois, which has some different laws than the state of Virginia. It does have licensing. It does have registration. In order for you to be a legal gun owner in the state of Illinois, one must possess a firearms owner identification card. We've also seen reports this afternoon of a shooting in San Francisco at a UPS facility. Apparently, two people dead and multiple injuries there in California. But David Frum, I don't think, has tweeted out anything about California's gun laws. Cameron, have you seen anything from David Frum about California's gun laws?
No laundry list tweets yet.
Okay. Apparently that's just a one-way thing then. Maybe David Frum got preoccupied with something. But this is, and again, that I think is a perfect example. Now, David Frum, if David Frum hadn't tweeted out that tweet trying to start the gun control debate while we were still waiting to learn what actually happened in Alexandria, Virginia, none of us would have been any worse off for that. None of us would have walked through the day thinking, you know what, I really wish somebody had tweeted something erroneous about the Virginia's gun laws, like right as we were learning about this story. You may have even had somebody fill in the gap. If it wasn't David Frum, maybe it would have been somebody else. But if that was David Frum's first reaction to the shooting in Virginia and Alexandria today, shouldn't David Frum then have the intellectual honesty to look at California's gun control laws when there are reports of a shooting in San Francisco? If that is his standard, if that's his metric, well, look at the gun control laws. Again, shouldn't you apply that standard somewhat equally? And there's no attempt to do so. There's no pretense at doing so. Right? Just like we hear this talk about, now is the time for a conversation about gun. Yeah, they don't want to have a conversation. I'm happy to have a conversation. We got to get beyond the talking points. You know, I mentioned Igor Volsky of Guns Down earlier was tweeting out about how we can honor the Capitol Police by supporting efforts to get guns. It wasn't get guns off the street. I think it was just like fewer guns in circulation or something like that. Again, no real discussion about how that's supposed to happen or what they actually want, but just the vague, vacuous statement about that's how we can support law enforcement. So I responded by noting this, a Police One survey from, I think it was 2013, 15,000 officers from around the country responding to the survey. 90% of them in this survey, almost 90%, said that the presence of a concealed carry holder at the scene of an active shooter situation would reduce casualties. These police responding to the survey, strongly supportive of the right to keep and bear arms, didn't think that additional gun control laws were going to make their job any easier, didn't think that it was going to reduce violent crime. Tim Johnson of Media Matters, that Police One survey, that's baloney. We wrote about this several years ago. Now, I know what they've written about me, so I'm not inclined to automatically believe anything that Media Matters says. But I tweeted to Tim the piece in the Albuquerque Journal from Michelle Carlino Webster, the Bernalillo County deputy, the widow of Albuquerque police officer Daniel Webster, who wrote about her personal objection to this universal background check bill that had been introduced in New Mexico, and also wrote about how the anti-gun advocates had tried to use her husband's death to advance this legislation that neither she nor her husband supported. That, to me, is not honoring law enforcement when you try to use their death to push for a law that they themselves would not have supported. Michelle Carlino Webster went into great detail about why her late husband would not have supported that legislation and why she did not. And then she went one step further. She did something that the gun control activists never do on a day like today. She actually talked about what we could do specifically to reduce violent crime. Specifically. She didn't offer any vague, vacuous statements. She said, you know, what we should be doing instead of pushing for bills like this is we should be dealing with these serious violent offenders who are committing these violent crimes, getting back out after a minimal period of time, and going on to commit more violent crimes. You want to really reduce violent crime? There, do that. Don't go try to pass this, quote-unquote background check law that's going to be largely unenforceable. When it is enforceable, it's primarily going to be enforced against people who had no criminal intent whatsoever, who had no connection to a violent crime. That's what you really want us to spend our law enforcement time and resources on? And she was rightfully outraged by both the use of her dead husband to further an anti-gun political agenda, but as a law enforcement officer, she was also outraged by what the anti-gun activists were calling for, because she knew it wouldn't work. She knew it wouldn't be effective. And that's her job, is to go out there and enforce the laws to try to reduce violent crime. She wants the most effective tools in her toolbox. You know, I mentioned Representative Tim Collins from Buffalo. I'm looking at a story here from the Buffalo News. We'll just mention it real quickly. Mayor in Buffalo, New York, Byron Brown, talking about the 23% increase in shootings in Buffalo, New York last year. Do you know that shootings increased 23% in Buffalo, New York last year? I didn't either. Cameron, didn't they put gun control laws in place in New York? Wasn't the SAFE Act put in place in 2013?
I mean, as a casual listener of this show, I remember. I remember you mentioned it once or twice.
I don't know. I remember that, too. Mayor said of the individuals arrested for gun charges last year, about 600 individuals, he said about a third had a prior gun arrest. 41 people, he said, were arrested on weapons charges multiple times just last year. He said the frustration that our police department feels is that to a degree there is a revolving door. He said these individuals keep getting out of jail and are allowed to return to the city streets. He said there is certainly a breakdown in the system that doesn't occur at the Buffalo police level. He declined to elaborate further on what he believes needs to be done. Well, at least there's a recognition of where the problem is. I suspect that one of the reasons, I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that one of the reasons the mayor didn't want to elaborate further on what he believes needs to be done is that it's not an easy fix. It's so much easier to say, you know what, all we need is this gun law over here or that gun law over there, or we just need to work to reduce the availability of firearms. All we have to do are make these vague and vacuous statements and promises, and that'll be enough. And maybe we can turn those vague and vacuous statements and promises into legislation, and maybe we can turn that legislation into law, and that'll be enough. Well, again, New York passed the SAFE Act 4 years ago. Shootings up 23% in Buffalo last year. Maryland passed the Firearm Safety Act 4 years ago. Baltimore, looking at a record number of homicides this year. We all in this country want to reduce violent crime. We do. I believe that, except for those who are committing violent crimes. I really do believe that the rest of us want to see a safer society. That's not what the argument's about. The argument is about how you get there. And I and millions of other Americans don't believe you get there by targeting the people who aren't out there committing violent crimes. I don't know that the mayor of Buffalo would go quite so far as to say that, but today looks like he acknowledged where the violence is coming from in Buffalo. All right, stick around. We got to take a timeout. When we come back, James Dellingpole of Breitbart London joins us talking about the police commissioner in Great Britain who kind of sort of went along with the idea that, yeah, maybe armed citizens could play a role in defending themselves and others against terrorist attacks. You apparently are not allowed to hold that point of view in Great Britain. You will be made to change your mind about that. We'll talk about it with James Dellingpole coming up right after this. So stick around. There's more Cam and Company on the way.
Dennis Santiago of Dennis Talks Guns joining us on the program right now. The base of gun owners has definitely expanded. So the new normal, so to speak, is a lot higher than it was, let's say, 10 years ago, or even when Barack Obama first took office.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, see, here's an interesting thing, because this came out of the discussions yesterday. I'm waiting for the data so I can look through the numbers and confirm it. But the indicators are that in the past 5 years, you know, there's that narrative that the only people that buy guns are the ones that own them now,
right,
or they're just bulking on them. Apparently, that's not true. Apparently, what's been happening is there's been this, within this noise of this politically driven stocking up by the people that do own guns, there's been a steady increase in new participants in the sport at all levels, and the breadth of the types of people that are entering into the sport are... It's expanding into just pretty much every corner of America that you could think of, every subset. I mean, I'm out in California, right? You know, and the biggest demand right now for, I'd like to learn to shoot the M1,
yeah,
in a CMP match, you know, because I instruct in that kind of stuff. It's gay guys.
Really?
Yeah, they're going, you know, that looks like fun, actually. And I go, it is fun. You should try it.
I think it's fantastic. You know, and as you say, there is no stereotypical American gun owner anymore. Mm-hmm. There just isn't. If you're, you know, you go to the mall, go to, you know, look around your office.
Yeah.
And that's who gun owners are in this country.
Yep, pretty much. You know, it's, and they're getting good at it.
Yep. Well, that's the other thing, right? You're right, because it's not that people have just become gun owners. They are becoming shooters. They want that training. They want to go to the range. They want that range access.
I'm a good person. I never bothered anybody. But I can't afford a nice house in a safe neighborhood. I live in a government high-rise. Gangbangers and drug dealers walk down our halls every day. My neighbors and I were scared. We called the police. But they can't keep us safe. Some of us are too afraid to even leave our apartments. But the housing authority told me if I bought a gun to protect myself, they'd throw me to the streets. If I'm not free because of my address today, what makes you think you'll be free tomorrow? I marched behind Martin Luther King at Selma. I know my rights. Now I have my gun. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
You have a right to be human, to follow your heart deep into the mountains, to renew your bond with the earth that sustains you, to breathe the wild air, to listen, to chase, and to take what you earn. Your humanity is not a disease to be cured by the manufactured guilt of the nonsense-stricken, tortured souls among us, or a perversion to be purged from your DNA. It is the very essence of your survival and every wild creature on this planet. For their sake, and for yours, trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. An hour from now, former New York police officer John Cardillo will join us. Also, next hour, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall. Later this hour, we'll talk with Stephen Gutowski of the Washington Free Beacon. And at the top of the hour, we'll have our Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, good guy. Right now, I want to welcome from Breitbart, London, James Dellingpole is with us at James Dellingpole on Twitter. James, good afternoon, sir. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, you know, we're obviously talking a lot about the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia. Congressman Steve Scalise among those injured by this attacker earlier today. And obviously, James, you know, this being the 24-hour news cycle, the anti-gun advocates always being quick to try to politicize an event like this. They have jumped on the gun control bandwagon. We've heard Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe bring up gun control already. Members of Congress, Republicans like Mo Brooks, who was there at that practice field, they've been asked, has this changed your views and your opinions on the Second Amendment? So we're already talking about the gun issue in the United States. I thought it was interesting that you all are talking about, at least to some degree, the gun issue in the United Kingdom as well. There was a British police commissioner who was on BBC, a BBC affiliate, and was asked about this by apparently a gun-owning woman who said, listen, if there's a terror attack, you know, can we use our firearms to protect ourselves and to defend against the terrorists? This police commissioner, Dame, she did not immediately shut down that idea. And it sounds like in not shutting down that idea immediately, the police commissioner may have committed a thought crime herself.
Yes. It's interesting, isn't it? She would have been these are quite police commissioners in this country. They have only existed in the last couple of years, I think. And she would have been elected by people in her local district. And it's interesting that there is a gap between her thinking and that of the police in her district. She made this statement saying, yeah, she wouldn't be averse, for example, if there were a terrorist incident for people with licensed shotguns, which is about all the weaponry we're allowed in this country now. Handguns were banned a long time ago. She would not mind if people with shotguns helped avert a terrorist incident. You know, we went in there with their guns. She was immediately sat on by one of her local senior policemen who said, no, not at all. We would not approve of this. We would actually punish people who took the law into their own hands as he saw it. So you've got this disconnect between a politically correct police force and an elected police commissioner. I think a lot of us are thinking now that the world has changed. There are guys out there with guns. Mm-hmm. There aren't enough police out there with guns. We do. How do we defend ourselves? This woman, I think, was responding to that public view. But you've got the police who, let me tell you, for a decade now, or perhaps longer, have been infected by this politically correct view. They don't want an armed populace. They believe that defense of the realm should be internal defense should totally be the job of the police. I think that it's going to be interesting over the next few years as the Islamist terror situation develops, this battle between people like that woman and people like the local policeman.
Speaking again with James Dalrymple of Breitbart London, the police and crime commissioner for Devon and Cornwall, Alison Hernandez, you know, James, she didn't even say, like, that's a great idea. You know what? We should arm everybody, right? All she said was, you know, it's a good question. Will you write that question down? And I, Alison Hernandez, I'm going to formally speak to the constable about it. The presenter then kind of freaked out about this, was like, wait, yeah, that's a good idea. What are you talking about? It's a good idea. And she said, because this might be a some of our solution to our issues, she said, I'm just saying, let's officially have a look at that, see what would be the implications of it. Let's unpick it a little bit. She said, we work with businesses to keep our community safe. I'd be interested to explore that with the chief constable. And that's, again, you're not allowed to have that. The indignation of that presenter for BBC was just, I mean, it was palpable, James. Like, how on earth could this woman be saying this thing right now? You can't say that. You can't seriously be suggesting that this is even an idea worth considering. Meanwhile, you've got the former head of Interpol, Ron Noble, who used to work for the Clinton administration, big believer in gun control. You and I have talked about this before. It was the terror attack in Nairobi, Kenya, that made him start thinking about, okay, well, what about armed citizens? Would this play out the same way in Texas or Colorado? We can't harden up every target out there, but we as individuals can be able to respond to a situation if, God forbid, we ever need to. You've got actual law enforcement officials saying, yeah, you know what, we need to have this conversation. And you've got the media, and I think maybe a lot of the cultural figures in Great Britain saying, no, you can't have that conversation. We won't have that conversation.
You're talking about a national religion here. Just as we believe that our broken, appalling health service is the envy of the world, which it's not, by the way, let me tell you. It's Obamacare look good. At the same time, we have this other national religion, certainly among the liberals, which is we are not like those terrible Americans. Those Americans so many guns and so many people get killed by guns and we are not like America and we feel all good and comfortable about this. Well, things have changed. And I think we discussed before that the incident in London, London Bridge, the terrorist attack, the London police were on the scene within 8 minutes and had taken out the terrorists. Devon, where this police commissioner is from, Devon is we're talking somewhere like, I don't know, Iowa or somewhere. We're talking about the middle of nowhere. We're talking about there are not many armed police there. You can imagine what havoc a few terrorists with guns could wreak in, say, a Devon market town. There would be no police to get there. So how would the citizenry defend themselves? I think it's an appalling situation. One of the most basic requirements of any government, the most basic requirement, is that it protects its citizens. And at the moment we have a situation where we the citizenry, agree not to have guns, not to have the ability to defend ourselves, in return for the guarantee by the state that it protects us. Well, I'm afraid to say we are entering a period. We're going to have this low-level insurgency for many, many years, possibly decades, possibly for the next couple of generations. How are we going to deal with it? I suspect that gradually Britain's attitude is going to shift. You cannot have an unarmed population versus terrorists who just want to kill us regardless.
James, listen, as always, sir, I appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you very much for your time today, and I hope you're right about that shift in thinking there in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
James Dellenpole, join us here. James Dellenpole, at James Dellenpole on Twitter, and we'll talk again very soon, James. Thanks again for your time today. John Cardillo next hour, also Stephen Gutowski of the Washington Free Beacon, coming up here in just a couple of minutes. Associated Press reporting about 40 minutes ago, the hospital says that Congressman Steve Scalise is in critical condition following the surgery for the gunshot wound to his hip that had been reported earlier today. So we are keeping our eyes on Representative Scalise's condition. Obviously, your thoughts and your prayers would be greatly appreciated by the family at this point. We are also continuing to follow the media reaction to this shooting in Alexandria, Virginia today, and the political reaction as well. We've also been following what's going on in San Francisco, where a UPS warehouse was the scene of a shooting earlier today. The Associated Press, quoting San Francisco Assistant Police Chief Tony Chaplin, said that when officers found the attacker there in San Francisco, the attacker killed himself. They report that three people were killed as well as the attacker, two others wounded in that shooting at a UPS warehouse in San Francisco. So we'll continue to follow that story as well this afternoon and bring you more details. But Stephen Gutowski is going to join us here in a couple of minutes just to talk about the immediate reporting that we saw from so many reporters, both on the scene there in Alexandria and a lot of reporters who were commenting and chiming in who were not on the scene. You know, every time there's a breaking news situation, there's what I call the zone of confusion for several hours where you don't know a lot. You get a lot of contradictory information. You've got people who are maybe tweeting things out that they heard on a police scanner that maybe turn out not to be true or are never substantiated. It takes time in a chaotic situation like that for the facts to become known. Because a lot of times the people who are in charge of actually compiling the true account of what happened here, they're having to piece that together. They're making contact with eyewitnesses. They're gathering information themselves. And then once they know what took place, then we can know what took place. You may get reporters, as that political reporter, approaching somebody that he heard on the phone describing what happened. And you may get somebody like that. You may get somebody who doesn't say, no, I'm not going to talk to you because you're a member of the media. And maybe information leaks out that way. Law enforcement sources may contact a reporter. But generally speaking, you're going to have to wait for those officials whose first priority is not to alert the media and to not hold a press conference, but to secure that scene and then to start to establish a timeline of what took place, they've got to get that information because before we get to know that information. Media doesn't wait. That's not the job of the media. The media is not out there to simply say, listen, we don't know anything. We'll bring it to you all at the same time at a press conference. That's not how the media operates. You've got these reporters who are looking for any tidbit of information that they can get out there first. And frankly, if it's accurate or not, it's kind of secondary to having that bit of information that nobody else has, using that unnamed source to get that information out there and to run with it because your competitors don't have it. So if bad information gets out there, I guess the attitude in the media is, well, it can always be corrected later, even though we know, no, it sometimes can't be corrected. You can put out the correct information afterwards, but it might not get nearly the response or the listenership or the number of eyeballs or the number of ears that that original piece of false information received. Most of us as consumers of news see that as a problem. Unfortunately, most of the producers of news don't seem to care too much, which is why we are swimming in fake news these days. All right, stick around. When we come back, Stephen Gutowski joins us from the Washington Free Beacon. We've got much more Cam and Company still ahead, so stick around. Let's talk about Diversity Shoot. How long have you been doing that?
I've been doing the Diversity Shoot since February 2015. Right after Sandy Hook, New Jersey, like a bunch of places, lost their mind, and they tried to reduce our magazine capacity from 15 to 10 and pass a lot of different laws. I got actively involved then, and I went to testify. 200 pro-gun people came and testified. The day before the testimony, the committee told the newspapers how they were going to vote, and we were going to lose. While we were there, they were playing video games on their phone. It really was annoying. So I looked out, and I was the only African-American that was pro-gun at the event. And I'm like, there are lots of people of color that shoot. Why don't we come out? So I contacted Second Amendment groups in the state, and I said, do you have something to recruit African-Americans, minorities into your group to get them to participate politically? No one had anything. So I contacted Anthony Colangelo from Gun for Hire, and I asked him on February 1st, how do I get something like this going? February 9th, we had our first event.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so what's the response been? Who's coming out to these events?
Everyone is coming out to these events, black, white, Hispanic, women, men. My friend Sean from Black Bag Resources, he was the one that said, Tony, are you going to talk about it or are you going to be about it? I was like, I guess I got to be about it. So I actually got involved. And people have been showing up to the point, I'm the gun guy at work. And that's a heavy load to carry sometimes. But one of the guys says, my mom always wanted to shoot a gun. Her birthday's coming up. When is your event? I told him when my event was. He showed up with his mom. Her first gun she shot was my Glock 19. And that was provided by one of the ladies from Second Amendment Women's Shooting Club. They and all the Second Amendment groups all joined together at that event. She shot a Glock 19. She shot 22s. She ended up probably shooting a 308 by my friend Orlando Martinez. He brought a Springfield Armory Scout Squad. This lady had never shot a gun before 2 hours earlier. End of the day, she's banging it out with a 308. So I thought I'd never see her again. She showed up at the next event with her daughter and two friends. That's how you grow the Second Amendment. We all can do it. Bring a new person to the range, be a good representative, and only talk about guns. Don't talk about politics, nothing else. We're talking about the civil right of Second Amendment. And if you want to help me out, you can join and come to diversityshoot.com. And if you're outside and if you're in a gun-friendly state, donate to states that aren't gun-friendly. Help us out. We need it.
Absolutely. Talking again with Tony Simon. And Tony, you know, kind of piggybacking off of that, I think we've seen... So you've got gays against guns. You've got, we're really seeing like anti-gun groups try to slice and dice this and go after particular demographics, right, including African-Americans, including Hispanics, including the LGBT community. I think gun owners are fighting back organically, as you say, with things like this. But what would you tell somebody who would say to you, Tony, listen, man, I don't want to go to the NRA annual meeting. You know, I'm a minority. I'm gonna be walking around in a sea of white people, and I'm gonna feel uncomfortable. They're gonna make, you know, like there is, I think, this attitude for people who don't know what it's like to be here, what it's like to talk to NRA members. So what would you tell folks about the NRA and the members that you've met?
I'll say what I said at my last event. I asked everyone to raise their hand that had a firearms ID card in the area. That's what you have to have in New Jersey to be able to even touch a gun in a gun store. Everyone raised their hands. I said, look around if you're not a gun owner. All of these people had multiple background checks. If you got in a room in your church, you can't get this many people to raise their hand that had multiple background checks. We're good people. We're good people at the range. We're good people at home. And they're good people here. We're all gun people. We all believe in the Second Amendment right to bear arms. And it's really a bunch of good people. Give it a chance. This is my second one, and I'm going to all the ones in the future.
All right, well, we will see you in Dallas next year. I'll probably see you in New Jersey before then.
Yes.
But listen, man, thanks not just for talking the talk, but for walking the walk and being an activist there in New Jersey. You're absolutely right. These battleground states, it's critical that we've got men and women like you who are actually, you know, boots on the ground, spreading the word, bringing in people one at a time. You're making a difference. You're making a change. And I got to tell you, man, I'm really, really glad that we ran into each other today.
Yep, I really appreciate it. Understand, as gun owners, we got it made. There are no anti-gun parties. There are no anti-gun barbecues. We have barbecue guns. We have a good time. We have fun, and we spread freedom. You should recruit people into this family of gun owners. This is very important. To make the Second Amendment last another generation, it's up to this generation to bring new people in.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Coming up top of the hour, today's hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy. Right now, I want to welcome from the Washington Free Beacon on Twitter at Stephen Gutowski, Mr. Stephen Gutowski. Stephen, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good, Cam. How are you?
I am okay. I appreciate you joining us. Obviously, we are talking about the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia earlier today. Steve Scalise reported less than an hour ago to be in critical condition after surgery. And you were following along with the media machine this morning, Stephen. And let's talk about the media reporting here, because quite often we see some pretty poor reporting, specifically when it relates to the gun issue in events like this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see it every time something like this happens, right? You know, a shooting happens, and then immediately the media begins to cover the story. And this is right after that, we get a lot of factual inaccuracies just flooding every corner of our media landscape, which, you know, as a journalist, is something that troubles me and something that I want to do whatever I can to help alleviate the problem.
What did you see today? What were some of the common bits of misinformation, bad information going around?
Oh, man, there was, you know, it's all over the place. There's constant confusion about the difference between semi-automatic fire and fully automatic fire. Misusing the term assault rifle, misrepresenting Virginia's gun laws, pretty much anything out there. If, you know, you can name the error. It's I've seen it happen already in this story.
Yeah, and you know, we had mentioned this earlier. David Frum had tweeted out something that got thousands of retweets about Virginia's gun laws: no background checks, no licensing. You can concealed carry long guns without a license, I think he said. Yeah. You know, and again, Stephen, like, so first of all, there's the just immediately jumping on the gun control politics at a time in which we still didn't know really anything. But, you know, what bothers me is, well, that bothers me. The erroneous information that David Frum put out about Virginia's gun laws bothered me. But if you're going to do that, Stephen, be consistent, right? Now we know this guy lived in Illinois. So where's David Frum's tweet about Illinois' gun law? We saw a shooting in San Francisco today. Three people are dead. Yep. Where's David Frum's concern about California's gun laws? You know, there's this, I think, blatant attempt not only to indulge in the gun control politics immediately, But it's a very inconsistent position, right? They even somebody like David Frum, who would pride himself on being so intellectual, doesn't want to have an actual conversation. He just wants to tweet out his anti-gun talking points.
Yep. No, that's absolutely right, because I saw David Frum's tweet, and everything he tweeted was wrong. If we're going to take his actual words, he said no background checks in Virginia, which is obviously wrong, mm-hmm. because every state requires background checks on new sales or any purchases made through a licensed gun dealer. He said no licensing. Well, that's wrong. There's licensing for concealed carry in Virginia. He said no registration. Well, that's wrong, because while most firearms aren't registered, there's, you know, NFA firearms are still registered, even if you're in Virginia. He said that you could conceal carry a rifle, which is incorrect. The concealed handgun permit in Virginia only applies to handguns, as the name implies. And he said that open carry, you could open carry rifles and handguns, which is also it's true that open carry is not, you know, you don't need a permit to open carry in Virginia, but there are bans inside of city limits, including in Alexandria, on open carrying loaded rifles in Virginia. So every single thing that he said is incorrect. Now, you know, I'm sure he meant by saying some of these things, I'm sure he meant something more nuanced, but, you know, what he actually said was incorrect in every way.
Yeah, and it's being reported now by NBC News that the suspect in this case, James Hodgkinson, had a valid Illinois firearms owner identification card. Police were actually called out to his property in March because he was shooting apparently unsafely. Why they didn't do anything other than tell him to stop, I don't know. Apparently he had a history with police, Stephen. The most serious charges involved domestic violence, in which there were eyewitnesses, but the case was dismissed. It never went to trial, and I can only assume that perhaps the victim in that case withdrew the charges. We don't know why that case was dismissed, but oftentimes when the eyewitnesses disappear, they don't want to testify. A case like that becomes very, very difficult to prosecute. So, again, if we want to talk about the gun control laws, okay, let's talk about the gun control laws. But I'm looking at Igor Volsky right now from Guns Down. Quote, we know that tougher gun laws equals fewer deaths. He's responding to a tweet by Senator Lankford from Oklahoma. He said, please buck the $11,463 you got from the NRA and at least, quote, consider the tougher gun laws. You know, Stephen, you've covered this issue. You've talked to a lot of politicians. Have you ever gotten the impression from any Second Amendment supporting politician that you've spoken to that if the money that they receive in campaign contributions from the NRA went away, that they would immediately adopt their real position in support of gun control laws?
No, of course not. I mean, you know, politicians are politicians, but my sense of it is in D.C., I think the concern about the NRA from politicians is less about whether or not they're going to receive money from them and more about whether or not their membership is going to be turning out to vote against them or to vote for them, because that's where the NRA gets most of its political power, is less from the monetary donations and much more from the actual membership. I mean, the NRA has 5 million dues paying members. It's a very large advocacy organization, and I think that's what actually drives politicians to act one way or another, is whether or not they're going to see people turn out to vote against them.
Yeah, and as for the we know that tougher gun laws equals fewer gun deaths. Stephen, again, you cover the Second Amendment for the Washington Free Beacon. Actually, what we do know right now is that 4 years after the Maryland Firearm Safety Act got signed into law by Martin O'Malley, Baltimore is looking at a all-time record number of homicides this year.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and I would say certainly the data does not support that claim in every case, for sure. Right? I mean, we can look at firearm ownership by per capita and and look at the murder rates in the United States versus other countries, and you'll see that if that talking point were true, the United States would be number one by far in murder. And that's not even close. It doesn't even crack the world top 25 list. So, you know, as far as that goes, it doesn't seem to be a credible claim.
Were you, again, as somebody who covers the Second Amendment, you obviously have seen before the anti-gun activists, the anti-gun media hop onto the anti-gun bandwagon right away. Were you surprised to see how quickly it happened today?
Well, today I'll be honest with you, I was more encouraged today, than focusing on, yes, there were some people like David Frum and others who went right to that. And I, you know, honestly, I expect that to some degree after everything like this, it's going to happen. Some people are going to be disgusting, on Twitter or on social media. It's going to happen. I was more encouraged to see sort of some of the bipartisan unity on this, like, you know, the speech that Trump made, the speech that Ryan made, even some of the things that Nancy Pelosi said, and a lot of the other people in D.C. whose message was more that, you know, these kinds of attacks, this kind of political violence isn't going to divide us. It's only going to unite us. And, I thought that was something that I preferred to focus on. But yes, of course, I wasn't surprised that there were some people who were out there, even some prominent people, immediately politicizing this and saying disgusting things.
Yeah, unfortunately not. Stephen Gutowski with the Washington Free Beacon. Thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. It's good talking to you. I hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. John Cardillo coming up next hour. Also, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall. And again, that last tweet that I mentioned by Igor Volsky, I mean, that is indicative of the actual lack of substance, right? What's important is to attack a politician for his ties to the NRA, specifically the NRA. Although, actually, I take that back. Igor Volsky's making a slight breach of etiquette with the preventing gun violence through effective messaging. Because you're supposed to talk about the gun lobby. You're not supposed to talk about the NRA. You're not supposed to mention the NRA, just like you're not supposed to mention gun control. You're supposed to talk about the gun lobby. But since Volsky was talking about a specific campaign contribution, had to mention the NRA. So a slight breach of etiquette. But attack the gun lobby. Offer up the need to, quote, do something, but don't get specific. That's what anti-gun activists are told to do. That is direct from their playbook. And again, what do? Well, we need, quote, tougher gun laws. Igor Volsky's been tweeting all day. He has yet to actually find the time to explain what those, quote, tougher gun laws would look like. He's got plenty of time to tweet out every member of Congress who has tweeted about this attack on members of Congress in Alexandria, trying to gun shame them into supporting gun control. But he's not actually had the time to tell these members of Congress what specific gun controls he thinks that they should support that would have prevented or stopped an attack like this. And he won't, because that's, again, not part of the playbook. But when Volsky tweets out something as simple as, we know that tougher gun laws equals fewer gun deaths. Actually, we don't know that at all. You know, David Frum wants to talk about Virginia's gun laws. But if we want to talk about Virginia's gun laws, let's talk about Washington, D.C.'s gun laws. And let's compare the violent crime in the state of Virginia and the District of Columbia. Now, you'll hear people say, well, that's unfair. You're talking about, you know, an entire state versus just one city. Okay, you could compare the violent crime rate in Northern Virginia to the violent crime rate in Washington, D.C. And Northern Virginia is a very safe part of the state. Violent crime levels are very low. You might be better off if you're a gun control advocate hoping to compare the entire state of Virginia and the District of Columbia. But let's do this for just a second if we can. Got a couple minutes here before the end of the hour. If the premise of people like Igor Volsky is correct, and the tougher the gun laws, then the lower the violent crime rate. Well, Washington, D.C., Homicide rate in 2015, 24.1 homicides per 100,000 people. A violent crime rate of 1,269.1 per 100,000 people. 556.7 robberies per 100,000 people. And 614.8 aggravated assaults per 100,000 people in Washington, D.C., with the very restrictive gun laws, right? There's not a gun store in the District of Columbia. You have to demonstrate a specific ongoing threat against your life in order for you to get a concealed carry license. Every firearm must be registered in the District of Columbia. Compare that to Virginia. 2015, homicide rate 4.6 per 100,000 people, or almost seven times less than Washington, D.C. An overall violent crime rate, remember, in Washington, D.C., was over 1,200 violent crimes per 100,000 people. In Virginia, less than 200, 195.6 violent crimes per 100,000 people. 556 robberies per 100,000 people in Washington, D.C. 53 robberies per 100,000 people in Virginia. 110.2 aggravated assaults. Crime's a lot lower in Virginia. Even with the David Frum disapproved gun control laws. What about Maryland? What about Maryland? It's an entire state. Again, borders the District of Columbia. Pretty restrictive gun control laws, much more tighter since the Maryland Firearms Safety Act was passed back in 2013. Violent crime rate, 457.2, more than twice that of Virginia. Homicide rate, 8.6, almost twice that of Virginia. 164 robberies, about even with Virginia. 256.7 aggravated assaults per 100,000 people. That's higher than the Old Dominion as well. No, tougher gun laws don't automatically equal less crime. And in Maryland, in places like Buffalo, New York, they're actually going the other way. Stick around. We'll be back with more.
Citizenry makes for a stronger country, a stronger society, a safer society.
And we prepare for so much that leads up to pulling the trigger. Are you prepared to deal with what happens after?
It's as complete a package as we could possibly have put together. We want to give someone the tools so that they can make good decisions in a very stressful, probably the most stressful situation that they'll ever encounter.
Having the NRA actually put together standardized concealed carry training and putting the resources behind it, you know, says quite a bit.
Everybody involved has that real world experience, has the education, has the understanding.
You know that this training is safe and it will work.
From the tactical, we're ready up.
It's far easier than anyone understands for an innocent person to be convicted of a crime.
We live in a litigious society. You need an attorney that understands what you've gone through, that understands the legal parameters of this situation, and is going to be able to not just adequately defend your rights, but to defend your rights from the tyranny of restrictions that prevent you from being able to defend yourself. Protect yourself. Get Carry Guard.
Call 911, wait for the law enforcement to show up, and then call the emergency hotline on the back of their NRA Carry Guard membership card that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to all NRA Carry Guard members.
When we're talking about something like the NRA, we're talking about the largest civil rights organization in the country.
There is no other entity that has the expertise, the resources, the connections, the philosophy, and the infrastructure
There is no other organization in the United States of America that can do what NRA has done with CarryGuard. There is no organization that gives you that gold standard protection and assurance.
If I find myself in a position where I had to use my gun to defend my life, I can tell you right now, I'm going to be glad that I had the CarryGuard.
Wild turkey, venison stew, roasted pheasant, rabbit risotto. The chemical-free, just-picked ingredients and the absence of antibiotics in the freshest of meats are the essence of today's farm-to-table food culture. But hunters have been eating this way for centuries. This is their table, and this is their farm. Trust the hunter in your blood. In America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady. TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company starts right now here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Coming up on the program this hour, we'll talk with John Cardillo, former New York police officer, host of the John Cardillo Show. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, will join us as well. Right now, though, I want to get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy of the day. Obviously, our heroes of the day, our good guys of the day, without a doubt, the members of the Capitol Police Department and the Alexandria Police Department responding to this attack today, engaging that attacker, saving countless lives in doing so. But we've got some other law enforcement officers we want to recognize as well. And a story, our hero of the day, brought to you by AdCorps Defense from Pennsylvania, the Delaware County Times, Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. Linda Riley reporting on a victim in an attempted armed robbery who was able to defend himself thanks to his firearm. Upper Darby police continue to investigate what they're calling a self-defense shooting in the Drexel Hill section of the township. It was Sunday, June 11th, just after 11 a.m. A 60-year-old resident of Morton, Pennsylvania, sustained a gunshot wound to the knee. He, the 60-year-old, apparently was the assailant. The defendant, the individual acting in defense, a 24-year-old from Bridgeport, Pennsylvania. According to police, the 24-year-old walking on Bridge Street with another man, a 30-year-old man. They had just left a 7-Eleven. They were approached by two men who pulled up in a car. Police say the two men, father and son, got out of the car and walked up to the shooter with a knife. The knife, by the way, looked like a gun, but it had a blade. I don't know why anybody would carry that, but that's what the assailant had on him. Walks up to the guy with a knife in his hand and says, "Who's Kyle?" And the shooter says, "You need to know I have a gun," according to police. Police said the assailant kept saying, "I got a gun," or the defendant rather kept saying, "I got a gun, I got a gun, I got a gun." Police said that the individual has a concealed carry permit for a handgun. The individual pulled out his firearm, had it by his side, and continued to warn the individual with the knife that he was armed, that he would protect himself. Well, the knife-wielding man, according to police, comes forward towards him, and the defendant shoots him in the knee. He told police he purposely shot him in the leg, warned him numerous times when he came at him before he fired. The attempted attacker transported to Philadelphia, where he was treated and released, and then transported back to Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, where he was charged and then released on Sunday. Excuse me, not charged, interviewed, but not charged. Chitwood the spokesman for the police there in Upper Darby, Superintendent Michael Chidwood, said, right now no charges have been filed. The moral of the story is don't take a knife to a gunfight. Uh-huh. So a 24-year-old acting in self-defense there in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day from Indianapolis, Indiana. Might have to talk about this with Tony Katz later in the week. Three teenagers are facing serious charges following a violent early morning carjacking. This was reported yesterday afternoon, so this would have been Tuesday morning. The Indianapolis Metro Police Department arrested these three individuals after officers say they tried to steal a man's car near 29th and Martin Luther King. Victim says that he was sitting in his car, heard what sounds like a gunshot, hit his car window. He jumps out of his car. The three teenagers get in, and then they drive away. Lonnie Harrison was the victim in this case. He said the cops are telling me it was a brick, but it sounded like a gunshot to me. Said the suspects didn't try to hurt him, but with his windshield broken, he was too afraid to fight back. He said, I thought they fired a gun. I didn't take no chances. Said these young guys tend to shoot first these days. So Lonnie loses his car to these three carjackers. Police engage the three carjackers in a brief chase. Lonnie really loses his car when the three suspects crash Lonnie's car after that brief chase with police. A 15-year-old, two 16-year-olds taken into custody. Lonnie Harrison says, quote, they had no business being out. I think they did an adult crime, so they should do the time. Fox 59 in Indianapolis says, unfortunately, if history is any indication, Lonnie won't get his wish because each of the three underage suspects has a long criminal history beginning when they were all 13. And you got a 15-year-old and two 16-year-olds. How can you have a long criminal history? You haven't been around a long time. But for the past 3 years, these individuals have been well known to law enforcement in Indianapolis. This is not, it's not like this was the first time they got caught, much less the first crime that they committed. The first 15-year-old suspect arrested in March and June of 2015 for burglary and weapons charges. The second suspect, according to Fox 59, has been arrested at least four times, including once on a similar car theft and police chase. The third suspect has the longest rap sheet of them all, including a warrant arrest this year, as well as multiple car theft and drug-related arrests. Lonnie Harrison, the victim in this case, says the system needs to find a way to hold teens accountable when they commit dangerous violent crimes. He said these kids today are grown. They want to do grown stuff. They need to be punished for grown stuff. Well, again, they're probably not going to be punished for grown stuff this time. Probably not. And, you know, this is what, again, this is one of those conversations that we need to be having. We really don't want to have it, but we need to be having these conversations. Nobody wants to see the juvenile justice system look like Alcatraz, right? Or the gulag. Nobody wants that. You want to, the ideas in the juvenile justice system, okay, you've got these individuals who hopefully are young enough that we can work with them. We can help them so that they don't continue down this path. You only get so many chances to do that. You only get so many opportunities. And ideally, you want to have those opportunities before they enter the criminal justice system. But sadly, what's happening, and this isn't just an Indiana problem. This is a problem throughout the United States. It's a systemic problem. The juvenile justice system isn't really designed right now to help these individuals. It's not designed to turn them away. It's designed to keep an eye on them, and a lot of tough talk about violating your probation. You got to stay on the straight and narrow, or we're really going to come down on you. And they, sadly, too many of these individuals learn very quickly that that's an empty threat, that the system does not come down on them, that they violate the terms of their probation, they violate the terms of their parole, and nothing serious really happens to them. They might have to go back behind bars for a couple of days. If you're a juvenile, probably not even that. But there's no follow-up. The probation system is overworked. The probation officers don't have the time to spend with each individual that they're supposed to be supervising, that they should. We rely on technology like the electronic monitoring bracelets, which don't always work, and people have been committing crimes while they've got them on their ankle. Again, this is the supposedly the best opportunity to try to turn individuals like these three teenagers arrested in Indianapolis onto a different direction. And we're not taking advantage of it. We're not doing it. And these criminal histories grow longer by the day. The revolving door of justice continues. And sadly, these three individuals, I imagine one day we'll actually learn their names, because they're likely to be arrested for violent crimes as an adult, too. Until then, these anonymous teenagers are today's deal of the day. Our good guy today from KHQ Channel 6, Post Falls, Idaho, where a police officer not only saved the leg, but saved the life of a teenage boy recently. Xander Fortune said, "We were cutting down a tree in my backyard. The tree started to fall the right way, and then it went off to the side and it pulled me with it. I took a giant step forward and the chainsaw caught my leg." Oh, I'll give you a second there just to wince. Xander's mom, Tammy, says she remembers her son yelling for his dad. She said, "I saw my husband carrying Xander to the steps. I saw blood running down his leg. My heart just started pounding so hard." As a parent, I can imagine. So Tammy gets a towel. Husband calls 911. She's putting pressure on her son's leg to try to stop the bleeding. She said, I sat there looking at him, and he was terrified, asking, "Am I going to lose my leg? Am I going to be able to walk again?" She said, "It's really hard when your child looks at you and asks that." She said, I tried to keep it together. I know I was crying. I just said, no, you're going to be fine. He's worried about losing his leg. You as a mom, you're worried about losing his life. Well, Post Falls Police Sergeant Gary James was the first to arrive. Again, took him a couple of minutes because police can't be there right away. But he sped to the scene as quickly as he could. First one there. He said, "I asked mom if the son had arterial bleeding. She nodded yes." He said, at that point, all of our officers are equipped with a CAT tourniquet. So breaks out the tourniquet, not only able to sustain that bleeding and save Xander's life, but again, the leg was not lost. Xander is out of the hospital. His mom, Tammy, says he's going to make a full recovery. And to me, that's the best thing. There's nothing else that I could ask for out of a bad situation. And recently, Gary James went back and paid a visit to Xander Fortune and his family. He said, "Honestly, I don't feel like a hero." He said, "Any of our officers in this position would respond. We're all trained the same. They would all pull the tourniquet on in this type of situation." Xander gets to go back to playing basketball in about a month. He gets his stitches out, which is fantastic news. And look, I understand what Sergeant James is saying. Yes, they get the training. Yes, that's part of their job. But, you know, it's still worth praising, and it's still worth acknowledging, and it's worth recognizing. And frankly, you know, given this story, given the attack in Alexandria today, and I was thinking about this earlier because Laura Carno, you know, from the Coalition for Civil Liberties, is getting ready to host that faster training for educators in Colorado. And part of that training is all about firearm safety, how to be proficient, active shooter threats. But part of that training is also first aid. What to do, and it could be an active shooter situation. It could be a knife attack. It could be an accident there in the school. But every one of those educators who's undergoing that faster training is also undergoing, as part of that training, education on what to do from a first aid perspective. And I think that is so vitally important. I saw somebody tweeting this earlier today. I wish I could remember who it was. Said, you know, beyond the issue of carrying a firearm for self-defense, beyond that, not everybody's going to do that. But one thing that we can do, knowing that we live in a world with random and dangerous threats. Look, if you don't want to carry a firearm, I'm not going to be the one to say you have to. That's not what I'm about. I'm not part of the "you must live like me" brigade. You be you, I'll be me. But if you don't want to carry a firearm for self-defense, if that's not something that is, has ever crossed your mind, it's not something you could ever consider doing, think about first aid. Think about what you could do if you ever were put in that situation as a first responder. You might not be the one carrying a firearm. That's okay. But what could you do? Could you save a life another way? Could you know CPR? Could you have that training in dealing with a violent attack? There are things that we can all do, again, recognizing that we're all ultimately on the same side here, as long as we are not one of those who seeks to harm innocent people. It doesn't matter if you're a gun owner or a Second Amendment supporter. There are all things that we can do and be on the same page. And that would be one thing. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we come back, John Cardillo, former New York police officer, joins us. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, will be with us later in the hour. We have more from Alexandria. We will continue to bring you the latest information, including now threats that are coming into members of Congress. Representative Claudia Tenney, a Republican from New York, got an email, one down, 216 to go. CBS News' Rebecca Shabbat reporting the body of the email read, do you not expect this? When you take away ordinary people's very lives in order to pay off the wealthiest among us, your own lives are forfeit. Certainly, your souls and morality were lost long before. Good riddance, was the email. And here's the thing. You know, what we've seen, Cameron, I've seen similar comments like that, not directed towards a member of Congress, but just directed out, you know, generally speaking, on social media today. I would not even say that that is an unknown a thought expressed.
No. No. And you know, you talk about how I spend a lot of time on Twitter and just watching it, and just devolves. And as the day goes on, it just, that the Rolling Stone gathers no moss. It's just more people pick up on this and more people are defensive and more people are fighting. It's just, it's one of those days you just got to stay off it. I mean, as soon as the show's over, I'm off.
Well, I'm driving up to the mothership, so I'll be social media free this afternoon. And, you know, look, I've been talking on Twitter, but if you notice, I'm not attacking anybody. Igor Volsky, I've been talking about Igor Volsky from Guns Down on the program throughout the afternoon. You haven't heard me call him a name. You've not heard me attack his character. I disagree with his position. I think it's wrong to start calling for gun control at a time like this. And as he has been trying to claim on Twitter that fewer guns equals fewer deaths, I have pointed out what's going on in places like Baltimore. But I'm not attacking Igor Volsky personally. Igor Volsky and I have actually had conversations on Twitter about the TV show The Americans. Like, I know of nothing else. Igor Volsky and I agree that The Americans is a pretty good show. Not sure how he feels about this last season. I thought it was the weakest of the five. But we've had those types of conversations. You can engage. I would love to see more of this type of engagement. You can engage with people that you disagree with without engaging in that politics of destruction. Now, it's rare. And again, I don't think it's helped by organizations and outlets like, let's say, Media Matters for America, whose individuals go to work every day trying to portray the subjects that they write about in the worst possible light. You know, Media Matters never talks about or comments on policy positions that, or the policies that we'll talk about here on Cam and Company. They don't want to talk about what's going on in Baltimore. They don't want to talk about me bringing up Maryland Firearm Safety Act. But if they can try to call me a sexist or a racist or a xenophobe or whatever, they'd do that. That's what their model is. And there are those outlets who exist to simply try to demonize the other side. I'll be honest with you. I can disagree with people. I can disagree with their policies. I can think that their policies are destructive without otherizing them to the point of inhumanity, where I cannot see them as human beings. That is absolutely destructive. And we are seeing a lot of that, unfortunately. And we're seeing it, again, come into congressional offices today. All right, stick around. When we come back, John Cardillo, former New York police officer, Kurt Schlichter later in the hour as well. Stick around. There's more Cam and Company coming up next. So what can the public do to help Hero Hunting?
The biggest thing right now, obviously, is financial support helps us because it helps us buy licenses. It helps us get gas. It helps us get to where we need to go to the different events that people put on for us and the events that we put on for ourselves. I mean, the events that we put on for our heroes. So that, if there are any outfitters out there that would want to donate some of their time or their location to bring some guys out, we keep small groups because we've dealt with bigger groups before, and it's not personal. There's 10 or 15 people running around. You got to be here. You got to be there. We keep it 3 to 5 on every event. That way it's a personal experience. That's where the family concept comes from. These started on our farm in Nashville, bringing people we didn't even know into our homes, pairing up with guides and family members and taking them out on these hunts on our farm. And we sit around our family dinner table, and that's where we started. We're very grassroots, and that's what we do. So the biggest thing we need help financially. We need places to take them to, and just spread the word in case there are people out there who don't know about us, who are in a bad place, who we can help. We're on Facebook. We're at Hero Hunt Inc. At gmail.com, and our website is herohuntinc.org.
So, listen, I wish you guys all the best. If you are looking for places to hunt in Virginia, let me know, because I know some folks who've got some land.
Oh, wow.
And again, I mean, this is just such a critical mission that you guys are on. Saw another story this morning, actually, of a veteran who committed suicide yesterday. Leaves behind a wife and two kids. This is happening every day. It's happening way too often. And you know, I want the men and women to know that they're not alone, that they don't have to feel this way, that there is help, and that there are people out there who understand. Like, I don't understand. I confess, I've never been in a war zone. I've never been in combat. Never served in law enforcement. But there are people out there who have those experiences, who can help, who do want to help, and are willing and waiting for folks to reach out, and they're trying to reach out as well. So thank you guys for what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time, and we appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk to you guys today. This advertising dollars are so expensive for us, but this gets it out in front of some people that maybe we can save some lives.
Joe, Jose, thank you both, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Great seeing you. Thanks so much. Hero Hunt Inc. here at NRA Annual Meeting.
I spent almost 2 decades working for the CIA. I've seen up close what so many people don't want to imagine, the frightening reality of radical Islamic terror. Here's the truth no one wants to admit. We will never see a day for the rest of our lives where that threat doesn't hover above our heads. Because the hatred that fuels these jihadists will burn for generations. The question is, will our freedom? If we surrender our privacy rights, our speech rights, our religious rights, and our gun rights, we will not be safer. But we will doom our children and grandchildren, and the billions of people around the world who see America as a beacon of hope, to utter darkness. Our freedom makes us great. Our freedom will keep us safe. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Somewhere over this horizon sit a million little dictators, eager to purge humanity of its hunting instincts. Contrived emotions flood from their air-conditioned, glass-paneled, Wi-Fi-enabled habitats, over the mountains and out into the wild, from which they hate to admit they emerged. Their foolish quest to force nature to fit their feelings threatens the survival of every living thing on our planet. If their fevered tantrums are ever imposed, the Earth will be ruled by the deadliest combination in the natural world: human ignorance and human arrogance. Travel another path. The truest path. Nature's path. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, host of the John Cardillo Show, former New York police officer John Cardillo is with us on Twitter, @JohnCardillo. John, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. How are you? Sad day.
It is a sad day. And I know that you've been in contact with your brothers and sisters in law enforcement there in the D.C. area.
Yes.
Can you tell us anything that that you've been hearing this afternoon from your sources in law enforcement?
Really, just everybody's talking about, well, the media has been pretty accurate in what they've reported. Really, the story that everybody's talking about is how proud they are of the response of the Capitol Police special agents on scene and the Alexandria PD officers who responded within minutes, 1 or 2 minutes, and engaged the bad guy in gunfire as well. I mean, it was really textbook protective detail work, and people in the law enforcement community nationwide are just beaming with pride. I mean, they're also very, very happy that no, the injuries weren't more severe. Although I believe the lobbyist who was there is doing far worse than everybody else. He's in critical condition, but thankful that no one was killed.
Absolutely. And John,
look, that's
I mean,
bad guy, right?
Well, yeah. And you know, look, you've seen it over the course of minutes, you know, this quickly became about gun control for some folks. I think as the political affiliation and political philosophy of the suspect has become known, it has become much more important for some on the left to try to make this about gun control. I'm looking at a piece at Vogue right now. Michelle yeah. Ruiz, when will the GOP admit we have a gun problem? Amanda Marcotte at Salon. Lessons of the baseball shooting, gun violence feeds on itself, and even now Republicans won't listen. So, you know, we're seeing this concerted effort by the left right now, John, to try to make this about gun control. In fact, Amanda Marcotte, let me quote this just for a second here. The NRA's story, she says, about how scary black and brown men are about to bust down your door and kill your family are good for selling guns, but they were also the same narratives that helped propel Trump to the White House. If anything, the fact that a Bernie Sanders supporter apparently went nuts with a gun will increase the paranoia on the right, which in turn will only lead to greater attachment to guns. Fears of emasculation, racist anxieties about crime, power fantasies about silencing dissent through threats of violence, and a widespread loathing for liberals and their insistence on rational evidence, those things sell guns, she says. They also get votes out for Republicans. The party cannot give up one without the other, and so we cannot expect, she writes, that this spate of gun violence as close to home as this dreadful incident comes for Republican-elected lawmakers will do anything to change their mind. Not yeah. because of their deeply held beliefs, not because of their support for the Constitution, but because of fears of emasculation, racist anxieties about crime. I would encourage Amanda Marcotte to find one instance in the 13 years that I've been doing this program where I talked about scary black and brown men about to burst down your door. You know, this is it's amazing, John. Right now, even as you've got lawmakers saying, hey, you know what, can we try to find a way to, you know, come together? You've got folks out there like Amanda Marcotte who have to continue to try to push the outrage machine to write those clickbait headlines to keep feeding this toxic environment that that this suspect was swimming in.
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, I do my show daily. You do your show daily. I don't ever recall you saying anything like that. I know I didn't. And I frequent a couple of gun shops here in South Florida. I have never once, and you know, usually on the weekend I'm bored, I just pop in there to chat with the guys and see what they've got. I've never once seen any of the employees while showing someone a firearm, and people of all races are in the store buying guns these days,
mm-hmm.
ever refer to anyone's race as a reason to buy a gun, you know, potential suspect's race. It just doesn't happen. It's always the liberals that default to that. The liberals who live in gated communities, who tend to live in lily white areas and send their kids to private schools, they seem to always be the ones who default. It's almost as if they're closet racists and they're alleviating their guilt by deflecting and projecting on other people. I mean, how novel a concept, right? But I don't see any, you know, Kurt Schlichter, a good friend of both of ours, coming up after me. Kurt is probably the best political satirist today. I would argue that his articles are outstanding. I've never seen Kurt default to race baiting or race scaring, and he writes quite a bit. I don't read that on the right. I only read things like you just read from the left. It's almost 100% that I read it from the left.
Yeah, well, and unfortunately, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more of this because, you know, again, I don't think there are a lot of Slate or Salon writers or Vogue writers who really want to talk about You know, the tone. I'll go back to this, and don't get me wrong, John. I hold the individual attacker responsible for his actions today. I'm not blaming any member of the media. I'm not blaming Bernie Sanders. It was this individual. But as I said earlier in the show, I was looking at this guy's Facebook page, and it struck me that his Facebook page, 99.9% of it was political. I saw
it was a shrine.
I saw
it was a shrine to Bernie Sanders.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And since the election, it's been 99% political, but it's been attacks on Republicans. It hasn't necessarily been like, look, here's what I believe. Here's what we should be fighting for. It's been, oh my gosh, these terrorists, these Trumpers, they're awful people. They, you know, we got to get rid of them. I saw one post from this guy. And I didn't look at every post over 3 years, but I looked at hundreds of posts on this guy's Facebook page. I saw one post of what looked to be a grandchild out on a lake somewhere. A human response about, look, I love this individual. I think that, again, when you marinate in that, when you just stew, and that's what you surround yourself with, and you never break away from that. Your only interactions maybe are on Facebook groups with phrases like terminate Republicans. This group that was cheering what this guy did.
Yep.
You know,
luckily only nine likes. But you know what I was really impressed by and actually very proud of was mm-hmm. President Trump's statement.
Absolutely.
It was apolitical. It focused on the victims. It focused on Representative Scalise's family. And I thought it was such a class move by the president to release an apolitical statement. And what a contrast to Terry McAuliffe, the Clinton fixer. I don't even call him the governor of Virginia.
Yeah.
He's the Clinton fixer. Getting up there and using his 5 minutes on the mic after the Capitol Police chief spoke and Alexandria chief spoke and FBI special agent in charge spoke, he couldn't help himself. He had to use it to push gun control. And the president issued, I thought, an incredibly powerful and just a humbling statement. And it was the contrast for me. Democrats, liberals cannot ever make it about anything other than their political agenda.
Yep.
And McAuliffe really illustrated that for us today.
Yeah, you're right. I thought the president's – in fact, we played those two speeches back-to-back to start off the program today. And we played them a little out of order chronologically because Terry McAuliffe actually spoke at that press conference first. But right. I wanted people to hear the president and then compare that to what Terry McAuliffe was saying about, you know – John, he dropped in the line about, look, today's not the day. But let me tell you – you know, we got 93 million Americans dying every day, he said, from gun violence. We got to do something more. And
93 million.
93 million, he said. Yeah, he eventually corrected himself. But you know, look, this is the guy, and it didn't get a lot of attention this year in Virginia, but this is the same politician who vetoed a bill, actually two bills in Virginia this year, dealing with the right to carry a firearm. And the bills would have they would have allowed somebody, if you had taken out an order of protection against somebody because you're afraid for your life, while you're waiting for your concealed carry license to get processed, you're already a legal gun owner, you've already applied, but while you're waiting, you could carry on an emergency basis. And there was another bill that would have provided some subsidized funding, right? If you couldn't afford the training, well, then you could get like a credit for training. McAuliffe vetoed both of those pieces of legislation and said, you know, we don't need more guns on the street. It wasn't about more guns on the street. It was about for a 6 week period, somebody who is going to get a concealed carry license, they can carry on an emergency basis outside of their home because they're in fear for their life.
Oh, listen, you're preaching to the choir. And luckily here in Florida, we little known, but we do have that. So our Department of Agriculture, which licenses firearms, and this is why Florida is so great on the issue, they've opened about 52 additional walk-in offices with employees whose sole job it is to process CCW applications. So they brought the waiting time down from months to just around 3 weeks, usually less. A friend of mine got his in 8 days. But what they don't tell you, which you can find out pretty easily, is if you are under threat, if you're the victim of domestic violence and you have an outstanding protection order on somebody, or you're a law enforcement officer retiring in Florida from another state, and you just want to get your CCW, even though you have HR 218, they'll expedite it for you. They'll get it for you in a couple of days. And in some cases, instantly, if you've got the background and training and you're just waiting for the processing. It's that to me is just common sense. Vetoing that law or those two laws, especially the subsidy for training, people mm-hmm. are saying we want to be trained. It makes no sense. It is the epitome of statism, right? It's the epitome of nanny statism and big government. All the things that if you love the Constitution, you should despise.
Absolutely. And again, if you're in favor, remember, they don't want to call themselves gun control advocates anymore, John, right? It's all about gun safety. Well, if you're in favor of gun safety, how can you be opposed to training? How can you be opposed to an individual like that who is going to carry a firearm, who is already a gun owner? How on earth could you say it's a bad thing for that individual to be able to go and take a gun safety course or a concealed carry course if they couldn't otherwise afford it?
You know, it never made sense to me in those cases. Look, if somebody has owned a firearm, I mean, in a case like that, it's very simple, but I'm a common sense kind of simple guy. If you are under a protection order, you have somebody under protection order, and you walk in to the office that processes, whether it be police, agriculture, whomever, and you show them a 4473 or a copy of one or the receipt for a firearm that's been in your home for a year. You've owned this gun for a year. You've been a responsible gun owner for a year. They should hand you that CCW license on the spot. You've proven that you're responsible. You've proven you're not going to go out and commit crimes with that gun. Not that you should even have to under the Second Amendment, but it's ridiculous that we're even having this debate.
It is, but we are, unfortunately. And so I think it's important that we actually point out, you know, what the quote unquote gun safety rules that these anti-gun advocates want to put in place, what they actually look like, you know, and they're aimed, John, they're not going to stop gang violence. They're not going to stop guys like this who apparently had a FOID card. Now, this guy, this suspect out of Illinois, John, apparently had a number of run-ins with law enforcement, had some fairly serious charges against him, but they were dismissed, and they were domestic violence charges. You know, again, we hear these gun control advocates say, well, this shows the need for tougher gun laws. They can't point to any gun laws that they want to put in place right now. They've not been specific. They've not called for any specific legislation today because they know that there's nothing specific that they would call for that could stop an incident like this.
No, listen, I always say this, and you and I have talked about this so many times, and I did four other media heads today, and we had this conversation. These are the attacks that law enforcement loses sleep over, right? These kinds of things, because they're asymmetrical, they're low tech. It's one guy, it takes about 11 seconds to plan. You're never going to stop them. We have to stop trying to legislate away human nature. Mm-hmm. Things like this have happened since the beginning of time, since Cain and Abel, and they're going to continue to happen. You know, I mean, it really, you're never going to stop them. And if you try to legislate away maniacs or homicidal, ideologically driven killers, if you try to legislate away the ideology of terrorists by punishing good people, all you're going to be left with, I know it's cliche, are armed bad people. I mean, it's so ridiculous. But the hubris of politicians to think that legislation is going to change thousands of years of deviant or homicidal or violent human nature, they've gotten a little big for themselves, haven't they?
I think so. John, listen, unfortunately, we got to run. But I do appreciate your time today, sir. And hopefully we can talk again very soon. I know there's a lot to discuss that we had to leave on the table today.
You got it, my friend, anytime.
All right, thank you, sir. John Cardillo, host of The John Cardillo Show, at John Cardillo on Twitter. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, will be with us after a quick timeout. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more Cam and Company right after this.
Phil Schreier, NRA Museums. What is your exact title these days? It's hard to keep up with
you. What day is it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's senior curator, national... Or no.
You don't even know.
I don't even know.
That's embarrassing.
Hold on. I have a business card in my pocket.
Go ahead. Read off your business card.
Senior Curator, NRA Museums.
All right. Good.
We've expanded. It used to be just Senior Curator, National Firearms Museum, but we're growing.
That's why I ask, you know, because you're right. What day? Because you always have something going on. So, you know, for people who don't know, obviously you know, people know the NRA and National Rifle Association, but the museums that you guys have literally across the country are absolute treasures and gems, you know, starting with the main one in Fairfax where the NRA headquarters is. Talk about the museums around the country.
Well, our best kept secret is we're over 80 years old.
Wow.
You know, we opened the doors in Washington, D.C. in 1935 at the bar building at Farragut Square, which still stands.
Was that a good day for you?
It was. It was my first day on the job. Right. It was the second year of the FDR administration.
Is that when you interned?
Yes, I was interning. Back then, the NRA was comprised mostly of retired Army, Navy, Marine Corps guys.
Okay.
So the NRA salute was, that was the NRA salute back in the old days. And
thanks, Shecky Schreier.
And we were right across the street from the Army-Navy Club.
Okay.
So no work got done after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. No, nothing. And then we moved away from the Army-Navy Club to get some work done in 1935. 54, we opened a new museum at Scott Circle right across the street from the Australian Embassy. And we stayed there until 1994. Mm-hmm. And we moved to Fairfax and we opened up our flagship museum. 20,000 square feet, 3,000 guns on exhibit, a collection of nearly 8,000 guns. So you can imagine 3,000 guns in 20,000 square feet. That's a lot of guns in a small area. And any more guns, we had no more. So Johnny Morse, wonderful, generous individual at Bass Pro, offered the second floor of his flagship store in Springfield, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And so we opened up the National Sporting Arms Museum 3 years ago. We're ecstatic to report we just had our 1 millionth visitor.
Did you really? Wow.
1 million visitors have been through that so far.
One of the coolest things working here on NRA News, NRA TV, is we were there for the opening, and we did some live shows from there. And it's, and you know, not being from that area and learning that that Bass Pro in Springfield is the biggest tourist attraction in the state of Missouri.
It is.
So you already had that built-in audience, and then you have people who are coming in for the museum. So I would imagine it's an easy feat to get that many people in there. It is. It's stunning. It's a spectacular space.
Yeah, when they ran the numbers by me, I was, because we get 50,000 in Fairfax, and you would think, you know, being right by Washington, D.C., yep, we'd be, you know, have more respectable turnout, but we're outside the Beltway. Yep. We're not serviced by the subway system, so... And then the Frank Brownell Museum in the Southwest over at the Whittington Center. That's another fantastic installation out there, opened in August of 2008. And it's actually undergoing a capital campaign right now. They're trying to expand that. They're going to triple its size.
That's cool. So yeah, you obviously have a lot going on. If you had, of all the places and all the guns, what's your favorite gun that's on display somewhere?
Oh, well, there's no question that it's the... It's the Colt Browning potato digger that we found hidden in the basement of a brownstone in Manhattan. That
That's the only place there are guns, by the way.
Right, right. Yeah.
Somewhere in the brownstone.
Hidden in the basement of a brownstone. And it was used by Roosevelt's Rough Riders in Cuba in 1898. It is the first machine gun ever used by the U.S. Army in combat. And we have one of the two on loan from the National Park Service at Sagamore Hill National Historic Site on Long Island.
That's awesome.
Who are just over the moon ecstatic. They've lent it to us for a number of years, and we hope to have it a number of years more.
That's awesome. People want to find out more, you know, where should they go online? And then you also have stunning visual. You get pictures, you got videos all over the place, too.
We have an amazing website that have... it's grown considerably. We have every gun that's on the wall in the museum is high digital, high res images on our site and multiple views. So if you wanted to turn it over upside down, we've got the photography. We have beauty shots of our, what we call our national treasures, mm-hmm, our favorite guns. And that's it at nramuseums.org. And, you can visit us in Fairfax.
Welcome back to Cam and Company on NRA TV, SiriusX and Patriot 125. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. You can find our next guest at Kurt Schlichter on Twitter, senior columnist at townhall.com, author of Indian Country. Mr. Kurt Schlichter is with us. Kurt, good afternoon, sir.
Well, what a miserable day, huh?
Yeah, it is a pretty miserable day. All over the place, a miserable day. A miserable story out of Washington, D.C., a lot of miserable reactions to this awful story. And I'm curious. I'll just ask you a very open-ended question. I mean, what's your opening statement here on what we have witnessed today?
You know... Who couldn't have seen this coming? I mean, you know, when you dehumanize your opponents, and I'm not talking stupidity like, oh, you put a crosshair on a map over disputed districts, or, you know, you disagreed with me, or you, you know, you want to cut Obamacare. The outpouring of hatred, active hatred, and rhetoric that dehumanizes normal Americans, you know, led to something like this. And the, you know, and I think the fact that Washington, D.C. deprives Americans, including congressmen, of their Second Amendment right to carry weapons, and that's why they couldn't carry concealed, because they were going to go into Washington, D.C., made them even more vulnerable. Thankfully, there were two police officers there who, with great bravery, engaged a shooter with a long weapon with pistols and killed him. Good. But, you know, this is not unexpected. And I don't think it's going to I think after 24 hours, we're going to see things go back to normal on the left and back to the hate.
Quote unquote normal. Right. Because, again, it's amazing. Yeah. We heard what we can't normalize. We heard a lot of the left saying, well, you can't normalize this. You can't normalize that. You can't normalize Trump. But we should consider what has been normalized on the left over the last few months.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there, you know, you've got CNN's parent company sponsoring a play where, you know, the president's stabbed to death on stage and it gets a standing ovation. If that's the new rule, I got to tell you, I don't think they're going to like the new rules. You know, they play these coy little games. They want to be edgy, but they don't understand they're playing with fire. I've been to a place where people, you know, where violence was normalized. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, if you're not the toughest, best-armed guy, it's not a good place to be. And I don't think they are. I think they like playing at this, but you know, when the rules change, there are people who aren't playing. This is bad.
It is bad.
And, you know, frankly, I've written about it.
Well,
I hate to say it, but I'm right.
You know, I was. It's hard to talk with you and not bring up the premise of Indian country, which is that the country becomes so fractured. That there is a civil war that leads to continued conflict. And, you know, again, Kurt, I saw the reaction today. And I'm look, you know, I've seen the reaction to various events over the past couple of years. I know that people on social media oftentimes, you know, let the tweets fly and they maybe think, oh, maybe I shouldn't say that. I thought I saw some well-considered yet ill-conceived tweets today, people like Marcos Melitzis, you know, putting stuff out there like, ah, well, you know, the Republicans were asking for this. This is what the Republicans want, I believe, is what he said. You have others, you know, blue checkmarked individuals, people are tweeting out of their own name. It's not random eggs. It's not people using the cloak of anonymity. Reporters, opiners, who are all suggesting that that to one degree or another, that the individuals who were attacked today had it coming to them.
Yep. Look, there's an underlying premise of that within a lot of people and not just on the fringe. And again, if you change the rules, you've changed them for everybody. And if you don't want to live in a survival of the fittest territory instead of a civilized country, you better think really carefully about it.
But is this something that you saw... I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but is this something that you saw in Kosovo? I mean, can you talk about, again, a stable country, well, all things considered, a relatively stable country, that descends into this civil war that is ripped apart? And not everybody, it's not like the country equally divided, right? And 50% said, all right, we're going to stand on this side, and the other 50% said, we're going to be over here, we're all going to attack each other. You've got groups throughout society that are interested in attacking one another, and then I imagine you've got a fairly large group of people in the middle saying, hey, you know what, we don't want to die. We don't want to keep attacking each other.
You had a lot of that. I was there after the fighting. I was there to help pick up the pieces, but the villages were still wrecked. The people were still scared. After you go down that road, you don't just shake hands and be friends. I mean, it took, you know, thousands of guys with guns to maintain from outside the country and maintain peace in this small area. It's so demoralizing to see people wanting to toss away the stability that we have here for the fantasy that somehow they're going to convince normal Americans to just give up and submit. And, you know, I took some grief from some well-known blue check pseudo-conservatives today because I said what I thought about it. You know, a lot of we shouldn't politicize this. This isn't the time to talk about it. You know, let's play a hashtag game. No, this is exactly the time to talk about it because we damn well better.
Yeah, you know, look, I don't think that now's the time to talk about gun control. I don't think now's the time to talk about legislation. But I do think now's the time to talk about what's going on in this country.
Yeah. Are our lives forfeit because we're conservatives? Because if that's your premise, you know, how do you think we're going to react? You think we're going to go, oh, well, I'll just line up at the cattle car? I don't think that's not in the cards.
No.
Where does this go? What's the next step? Is it like one of those straightforward from here? Number one, conservative lives are forfeit. Number five, you know, socialist paradise. You know, and then question mark for 2, 3, and 4.
Mm-hmm.
Like you better fill in those blanks.
Yeah. So, you know, and I've been reading your Twitter feed today. And obviously, you know, look, I mean, I'll be really personal and really blunt here. My wife and I have had conversations over the past year or so as the rhetoric has become more toxic. And my wife's gotten very concerned that some anti-gun nut would somehow get in their head to try to kill me to make some sort of political point. We've had these conversations.
Could happen.
It could.
Oh, I get death threats.
We're well aware. I am well aware of the environment in which we live. At the same time, Kurt, I, like you, I don't want to see us go down this road.
No.
I said earlier today, I look around this country and I look around this globe, and my fellow Americans, no matter how vociferously I may disagree with them on whatever issue it is, even the nearest and dearest issue to my heart, they're not my enemy. My enemy is over there in North Korea right now. My enemy is in Iran. My enemy is hiding out somewhere plotting an attack to kill as many of us, no matter our political backgrounds or our personal points of view, as possible. That's who I'm worried about. My fellow Americans are not my enemy, not my the one that I'm going to target.
Well, the problem with that is I think some number of them think you are the enemy.
I know.
One today did.
Mm-hmm.
This guy would have murdered these people simply because they voted in ways he didn't approve. He would have murdered them if he was a little more competent and if those police officers weren't so brave. He would have shot them to death simply because they disagreed with him. And there are people out there who think it's okay. And there are more people out there who think it's okay, but just don't want to say it. And you can see that you can feel that underneath. Maybe I missed it. I don't see a giant outpouring of liberals saying, "Oh my God, we should look at ourselves today."
No, this is one of the reasons why I think we're seeing so much so many attacks on gun control. They don't want to talk about.
No. They want to turn around. This just emphasizes the need for every conservative to be armed. If you are a law-abiding citizen who's capable of doing it, you need to have the means to defend yourself, your family, your community, and your constitution. It's not just an option now. I think it's a moral responsibility if you are capable of doing so, physically, legally, emotionally. I mean, there are people out there who are just not born to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't expect people to do things they simply can't do.
No, but made this point earlier.
Calls.
And if that's you, if you don't want to carry a firearm, you don't want to get a concealed carry license, again, I'm not the type of person to say you have to live like me. That's not my point of view. But think about what you can do, right? Maybe it's first aid training. Maybe go ahead.
First aid training saved people's lives today. Fortunately, there were some doctors there. There was at least one Iraq vet who mentioned, at least in Iraq, I could shoot back, who knows combat lifesaver. Steve Scalise is probably alive because of those guys today, though I've heard his case took a turn for the worse, so we all need to be thinking and praying for him.
Absolutely.
If this is the new normal, you know, we need to address that.
How do,
and That means protecting ourselves, protecting our families, and calling it out. And this idea that I'm above it all, I'm not going to lower myself to talk about this because it's ugly. No, this is, you need to talk about it. We need to talk about the dehumanization of half of America by the left. It's not a, well, the right does it too thing. That is a lie. That is untrue. The threat is very clear. We know who it is and who's doing it. And to try and play a moral equivalence game is just a lie.
Again, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, buddy. We're almost out of time, but I look forward to doing this again very soon.
I hope so.
All right, man.
Under better circumstances.
Absolutely. Kurt Schlichter with us here on Cam and Company. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Jim Garrity of National Review is going to be spending some time in studio with us. Also, Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms, Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review, David Arsani at The Federalist will be with us on tomorrow's program. We will have continued coverage of this, continuing story in Alexandria, Virginia, and how this is all playing out around the country in terms of the political debate, the media coverage, the social media environment and the responses. All of that coming up. But again, in the meantime, keep Steve Scalise and the other victims today in your thoughts and your prayers. Keep their families in your thoughts and prayers as well. Keep this country in your thoughts and prayers. We are not in a good place. And I wish that I was a political Nostradamus and could predict where we were going and could tell you that, you know what, this is, we've hit bottom. We're going to get better. I don't know that that's the case. I really don't. I'm very concerned about the future of this country. I'm very concerned about where we're going. But I will reiterate what I said again. In the grand scheme of things, at the end of the day, we Americans are not each other's enemy. We may be political opponents, we may be political foes, but we are not the greatest threat that we face in this country today. And as long as there are Americans who continue to see their fellow Americans as the greatest threat to their lives, we're going to be in this precarious position, in this bad place. So be safe, be prepared, but don't give up hope. Don't stop reaching out. Don't isolate or silo yourself. Let's engage. Let's get involved. And we'll see you tomorrow live, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV, midnight Eastern on Sirius XM Patriot 125.